establishes the Lessard Heritage Enhancement Council in association with the Heritage Enhancement Fund that would be created by the dedicated funding or outdoor heritage amendment that was passed and to be placed on the ballot this coming November. It is very similar to what the Senate passed last year, and so we did have a full discussion of this. But by way of background, last year and now with this bill, we discussed the importance of having a mix of citizens and legislators involved with the distribution of at least the Heritage Fund portion of the dedicated funding. That would be the one-third, the one-eighth of three-eighths of a percent, or $91 million in the first year. We came up with this proposal because it is similar to the structure for the Legislative and Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources. A couple of years ago, that commission was changed to include citizens, with a majority of the members being senators and representatives, legislators, and a minority being citizens. But any recommendation for the allocation of trust fund dollars has to be approved by a supermajority of that group. I'm a member of that commission, and so I'm very familiar with the dynamics that were created by that model. I'm proposing this legislation, this structure for the distribution of the Heritage Fund, because as we did last year, the LCCMR model, in my opinion, has been very successful in doing a few things. First of all, it provides for direct citizen involvement in not only the general discussion of distribution of funds, but makes them intimately involved in the decision-making and the review of proposals. And that has had two effects. One, it obviously has increased the input of citizens. But I feel that it has also decreased the internal partisanship that can sometimes result when committees are simply comprised of legislators. I think that's been a great benefit. Additionally, I would say that that legislators have benefited from the knowledge that citizens have provided on the committee. They're direct provided from by the citizen members from their real life expertise, and I think that's been a valuable contribution. Not that we can't get that expertise from testimony and elsewhere, but I think having them at the table has been a benefit. I think that the citizens on the LCCMR have gained a greater appreciation for the budgetary process, for the legislative process, and some of the hard decision making that it takes to distribute that type of money. So I think there's been benefits on all sides. Like any group, I don't think the LCCMR is free from politics. I think there are still political dynamics. But overall, I think we've produced a better product over the last 2 years than in the past. So relating that to the Heritage Enhancement Council, I want to propose a similar model. Last year, the Senate dedicated funding bill, contained a mirror image of the LCCMR. This year, it's a little bit different. I would say that I would call them tweaks or enhancements, and certainly want to hear the committee's input on them. But I think that we've improved upon last year's product as well. We do that by making the giving the citizens a majority on the council, a majority of 10 to 6. Having said that, the supermajority that is required to vote to approve an allocation of the funds still exists. And so whether one group has a minority or is a part of the minority or another, I think is less important as long as that number is meaningful and that supermajority exists that requires so that not one group can dominate the ultimate allocation. And I think that supermajority is the key to keeping a balanced dynamic. Like the LCCMR, the citizen members would be appointed partially by the House, the Senate, and the governor. Like the LCCMR, the citizens would be confirmed by the Senate. Like the LCCMR, again, there would require a supermajority for the approval of ultimate allocations. Excuse me. Different from the bill last year are the some of the allocations within the funds, the kind of the pre-allocations that we had. Last year we had a lesser percentage dedicated to forest fragmentation and consolidation issues. This does increase that amount. Last year there was also a lesser allocation to the conservation partners account within the fund, and this expands that. And the reason we expanded it is because, first of all, regarding the forest fragmentation and consolidation account, it has been discussed amongst many stakeholders groups that for northern Minnesota, it is really the forests that provide a majority of the habitat for their restoration activities or preservation activities. And as a result, we need to have a greater focus on that if we are going to make sure that our funds are ultimately balanced. For example, if we're always restoring or preserving prairies or wetlands, that applies less just as a matter of course to northern Minnesota where they have a greater percentage of forests. So it, I felt in drafting this proposal, and there are others who agree, if there are people who disagree, we'd like to hear that as well, but that we need to have a meaningful focus on northern Minnesota.
Senator Chaudhry, just to refresh our memory, what percentage was in there last year?
Maybe Mr. Knopf can refresh.
Mr. Knopf?
Well, Mr. Chairman, last year the amount for the conservation partners was $5 million per year. So this would be closer to $20 million per year for the conservation partners. I think the forest fragmentation was actually a little higher last year at 25%. This is actually a little bit lower.
Okay.
Down to 20%.
Okay, I thought it was closer to 10%.
Yeah, it was 25 at one time, so I thought that's what it stated.
Right, at one time it was 25. I thought this final Senate bill was closer to 10%.
Mr. Chairman, I think it was 25, but there was talk about bringing it down in conference.
All right.
Thank you.
In any case, the 20% is a significant amount that I feel we should be dedicating to the issue of forest fragmentation and consolidation. And then on the conservation partners account, in discussions over the past year regarding this idea where we would have a part of the heritage fund that would be dedicated to matching funds, directly dedicated to matching funds by local conservation clubs that would essentially double what they've been raising on the local level and allow those dollars to be directly spent at the local level by those clubs in their preservation and enhancement activities. This concept has been extremely popular amongst rank-and-file sportsmen across the state and has served to do two things. First of all, it gets dedicated funding dollars on the ground immediately. Secondly, it allows the rank-and-file sportsmen across the state to directly realize the benefits of dedicated funding, and so that they know actually in real terms, and it's in their hands how those dedicated funding dollars are spent, and this has been this aspect of the proposal has gotten a lot of buy-in to the whole concept of dedicated funding as a result of these discussions, and I really think it's proven to be a wonderful addition to the dedicated funding discussion, and I think we'll make our proposal and our effort at the ballot all the more popular amongst sportsmen, so that they can realize they can realize a direct benefit from their activities. So a Pheasants Forever banquet raises $25,000, $30,000, $40,000 at their banquet. X number of dollars of that, most of it more than likely, will be spent on conservation activities in their locality. They can then apply to the Outdoor Heritage Fund for an additional $40,000 to match the money they raised, and suddenly they've doubled their efforts, all because of dedicated funding. And it's a realization of dedicated funding dollars on the grassroots, on the local, and in a very direct manner.
And Senator Chaudhry, your enhancement council would set up the parameters on making that application?
Mr. Chair, it would. I'm glad you bring up that point. We wanted to set some parameters for how we wanted this Heritage Fund to be spent, and this was done in conjunction with sportsmen. But we don't want to be too prescriptive, and just like we do with the LCCMR, we're not too prescriptive with how at the legislative level of how that money is spent, because there's a reason why we're creating that commission, and the reason why we're creating this council is so that they can decide how that money will be spent. And I think having the citizen involvement with it, with a balance of accountability from people who have been election certificates, provides that important balance. One of the things that you've heard me talk about is the importance of breaking the stereotypes of who we are as sportsmen, and expanding the sportsman community beyond the current participation. This is a very important thing that we're going to have to do in the coming decades in Minnesota if we want to preserve the sport, our sport, and our industry. And as such, we're going to have to not only target our activities towards getting more kids involved, but we are going to have to do a lot more in attracting other people in our society into the sport. Women, minorities, immigrants, groups that do have an interest in hunting and fishing, the Hmong community, for example, a society very rooted in hunting and fishing. But we don't see them in this room too much, and we don't see them in the sportsman meetings too much. There have been efforts to change that, and DNR has done some outreach, and some of the groups are starting to organize and create their own organizations. But we have a long, long way to go. I remember in talking with one of my professional angler friends, who is African American, and he was a director of a bass tournament. And in our conversations, he has conveyed that he often gets the question, "I didn't know black people fished." And I think you only need to take one little ride down the Mississippi River to see that there is a huge community amongst African Americans that do fish and have an interest in clean water and an interest in habitat and preserving our sport and our industry. And of course, the Hmong community is avidly involved in hunting and fishing. So I wanted to make sure that there is representation from kind of non-traditional sporting demographics on the council. I do require that the citizen members be, I think it's citizen and, I'm not sure if the legislative, there's a legislative requirement as well, but that would make sense. But
it's only citizens.
It's all.
But there is a gender balance requirement
for
the council.
I see that. Senator Chaudhry, I think you've answered part of my next question about your thought process on 16 people and where they would come from. You certainly touched on gender and ethnic groups. How about the rest of the 16? Did you really have a game plan when you saw who might be appointed to this council?
Well, regarding the legislators, it's like the LCCMR. The Speaker of the House can appoint three members, the Senate can appoint three members, and then the governor, the House and the Senate can each appoint three members, and then at least one member from the Senate and one member from the House must be from the minority caucus. And then in addition to some of those demographic inclusions, we are very ardent in this bill about making sure that the citizen members do come from the sportsman community. Now, making sure that they have experience and expertise in the science, policy, practice of preservation, enhancement, protection of state's game and fish and wildlife habitat, have a strong knowledge in conservation issues. They have a demonstrated ability to work in a collaborative environment, that they, there's some specific language here about in the governor's appointments, those citizens have to come from different regions of the state and represent hunting and fishing stakeholders. And I want to make sure that I also indicate that I've made sure that there's strong consideration given to young people as well. I've set the age at age 30, just to make sure that we have a decent pool to choose from. But we need younger sportsmen to be involved with this citizen council.
Senator Chaudhry, are there term limits?
Mr. Chair and members, no, there's not term limits. There are terms. There are lengths of terms, and then they would have to be reappointed after that term, but there's no term limit, just as we have with the LCCMR.
Senator Chaudhry, do you have a list of people who are looking to get on the LCCMR? Are there people that are kind of waiting for their turn to serve?
The LCCMR, I'm sure that there are people out there, but I don't know if there's a actual waiting list of people. The people in charge of the appointments, the House Speaker and the Governor's Office, may have different information. But I wasn't aware of a per se waiting list. And I'm not aware of a waiting list either for this council as well. There is a process that needs to be vetted. People would submit an application. Each body will have it, have its own process. The governor shall have a appoint a selection committee to choose those citizen members. So no, there's no pre-designation here, nor is there one contemplated on who the actual names would be. And then finally, I think just like the LCCMR, the council would make recommendations, but then just like we do with the LCCMR, those recommendations would then have to be passed by the legislature. Stand for questions, or we can move to our witnesses.
Questions for Senator Chaudhry, Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, the Heritage Enhancement Council and the appointing authorities, the way this is listed now, 12 of the appointments will be made by the legislature and only 4 by the governor. And I'm wondering if you gave any thought to making that perhaps 8 by the legislature and 8 by the governor. And I'm thinking, trying to think far beyond current membership of the legislature and the current governor, what we might have in the future. If it were more balanced, the Senate is still going to have confirmation of the governor's appointees. Perhaps that should be something we have a little further discussion on further down the line.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, that's fine.
Chaudhry.
I want to achieve balance. I don't want a change in the governor or a change in the House or the Senate to tip the scales, so to speak. If one body sees dramatic change, I don't want that to have a fundamental impact on the rest of the membership. So if your suggestion achieves that, that's fine. We can certainly talk about that.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry,
Senator Fredrickson.
The other question I have and concern is the Citizen Selection Committee. And the way this bill is written, those members serving on that would only be eligible for reimbursement of travel expenses, and that might limit some individuals' ability to serve, particularly if they're coming from rural Minnesota, you know, a couple hundred miles away.
Members are referencing 311 and 312, I believe. Is that right?
Mr. Chairman, page 4, starts at the bottom of page 3, 3.26, that whole section. But the reference to which I'm specifically referring is lines 4.1 and 4.2.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, I intend for the citizen members to receive per diem. And so if it's not in here, we can add that.
Senator Chaudhry, I believe
this was raised in my discussions, and I thought it was in there.
Senator Chaudhry, I believe 311 and 312 makes reference to per diem expenses.
Mr. Chairman, that is for
legislative members. I'm sorry.
And then for 3.13 is for the citizen members of the Enhancement Council. What I'm talking about is the selection committee.
Oh, the selection committee. Okay.
And that's on page 4.1, 4.2.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, we can add that in.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Fredrickson, Mr. Knopf would like to weigh in on that for just a second.
I just wanted to make a point, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, that is the same status that we have for the Citizen Selection Committee for the LCCMR. I mean, these are just people who meet for a short term. And it's basically the same language that they just basically get their expenses paid, but do not receive per diem for on that citizens selection committee also.
Senator Fredrickson,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, I think they should be eligible for receiving per diem too. The per diem is $55 a day in the statute.
Yeah,
it's not a lot of money, and for some,
I don't feel strongly either way. I would just model this after the current LCCMR. Sure. So if the committee feels like it wants to add that piece.
And Mr. Chairman,
Fredrickson.
On page 4, line 1, I delete everything after the period. Page 4, line 2, delete everything up to as, and insert compensation of members is. And then on line 2, delete 15.059. And insert 15.0575 delete the comma in subdivision 6. So it would read, compensation of members is as provided in section 150575.
You're making that an amendment, Senator?
Right.
Does everyone understand the amendment? Senator Ingebretson.
I'm sorry, no.
To that point?
No.
We have an amendment before us. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Let's get into the testimony, and then we can go over
clean
more detailed stuff.
Thank you, Senator Chaudhry.
We just voted on it. We know that it's going to be a different status.
Sure. Senator Frederick says he's going to per diem for the selection to
make sure they get per diem.
Welcome to the committee. We need you to identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Roger Geschel. I'm on the executive committee of the Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance. We want to thank all of you folks for your hard work in passing this amendment. Our position paper, which I have a couple copies of that I will leave here, I'll read the statement to you. And it says that Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance position paper, which is Citizens Council and Dedicated Funding. Minnesota Outdoor Heritage Alliance, MOHA, wishes to thank the Minnesota Legislature for passing the Dedicated Funding Bill, or Heritage Enhancement Fund, that will provide close to $200 million a year to rebuild and enhance habitat for fish and game, and to clean our wetlands, lakes, and waterways. MOHA has some 45 constituent organizations that include all of the major hunting, fishing, and conservation groups in Minnesota. All of our organizations are unanimous in the effort to support passage of this amendment in November. We are all deeply committed to see dedicated funding for fish, wildlife, and the environment become a reality. All of MOHA organizations also feel that there should be a statutory language written and passed by the Minnesota Legislature that will create a Citizens Council to make sure that the funds raised by this constitutional amendment do, in fact, go for their intended purposes. We feel that if this council is not in place before the election this November, there is a greater risk for defeat. We urge the Senate Environmental and Natural Resources Committee and the Minnesota Legislature to provide this Citizens Council and to pass this bill. Thank you for the opportunity to give this testimony today.
Thank you, Mr. Geschel. Any questions for our witness? Moving along.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Bob Bouchard. I've been around here for a while. I used to sit where you were. I want to get a little history of this bill. I'm not going to go back. You've all heard it before. I think it was 9 years to get it this far, and there's been a lot of ups and downs. Prior to that, we had the constitutional amendment to hunt and fish, and that took 4 years to pass. And it was passed with 77%, I believe, arguably one of the largest percentages in the constitutional amendment, certainly with any controversy, which was astounding. And I think that illustrates what can happen if you get those of us that they call us hook and bullets crowd, but hunting and fishing behind it. And that's what happened. I think we had bumper stickers on everything from the milk cartons to trucks. I can't remember, but it was a huge effort. Prior to that, I carried the lottery bill, and that took me 4 years. And one of the big arguments for passing the lottery bill, and I know some of you were here when I got very involved with that and disappeared for a while, I won't go into the history of that, was that it would be used for the environment and outdoor resources. We passed that bill, and it was about 2 or 3 years. I think Senator Frederickson or some of you can are more, your memory is probably more articulate. What happened was they changed the funding of the bill. And that set in motion, I think, with the sportsmen and the environment, even people in the environmentalists, whatever, environmentalists, a thought process that you can't trust the legislature. And this brings to the point that I'm going to try to make here today. And that's this. I've been going around the state, have others, including Orrin Blumen just the other day. And everything, every question before this comes up, it's great, it sounds great, but where's the money going to go? And it goes back to the lottery, and it does. And I feel bad about that because I'm going to make a statement here. I said I'm not going to be involved in a bill that's going to perpetuate another farce on the sportsmen. I feel very bad. I and others went out and sold the lottery bill thinking that was going to happen. Having said that, I know that how important it is to have a council in place that the people, those of us who buy hunting and fishing licenses, can see where the money's going to go. If we can put that effort together and we can go out on the road and go to every sportsman's club or all around the state, I think we can pass. I'm also fully cognizant of what has happened after the tax that went through on the gas tax. I always turn on the press, and I understand there was polls taken right after that, so maybe others got what they were, how negative that was. So we have a huge obstacle to overcome. A huge obstacle. When I first carried the bill, I was taking it out of the existing base, and some of you are here, and I got criticized. Oh, my God, did I get... Whose fund are you going to take it out of? Well, what we've done now is turned it around and letting the people decide. And I think that you can sell that to your constituents because, as opposed to the legislature, you can say, we are giving you the right to decide on this. And then it's up to us, all of us who buy hunting and fishing licenses, to go out and do what we can to pass it. We would get our targets all the years, since Ellen, Senator, she's here somewhere. On water, how much do we ever get for water? What we wanted for the environment wouldn't even show up on the radar screen. You do a pie chart, it wouldn't even show up. And year after year after year after year, at least I would do my best to try to get it, the targets raised, and it was futile. And so now there are some of those that are saying, okay, the legislature should be making the decision, not letting the people decide. Well, we tried that. It failed. The legislature will never, ever, ever appropriate the money that's necessary. And I think this is a perfect opportunity for the legislature to say, okay, here's what it is, here's the package, we have the arts, I know we've got clean water, who can vote against clean water, we've got everything in it, and let's go out and sell it. And I think you can do that and go home to your constituencies and say, okay, we have given you people the right to decide. If it passes, great. If it goes down, it's not so great. But that's a chance we have to take. So I will conclude my testimony in saying, if you can pass this and you have a council that I and others can go out, and I will be out. I got an agenda, you guys see where I'm going the next 6 weeks to every single sportsman's group, then I can go out and sell it, and others can go out and sell it, probably far more better than I can. But I do know that that's the message. So if you can have a council again that we can support, I can't stress how strong that is, then I think we can pass this constitutional amendment, and I'll know that I'll do everything I can to help. And that's my testimony. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I want to say hi to my – I know some of my friends here up here have seen this one, have seen this before, and probably in a little different, different form. Before I close, there's one thing that I want to say. There's a little bit of confusion maybe about the forest legacy and how important that is, and the conservation partnership. Those are two key elements to sell it in northern Minnesota and to sell it to our sportsmen's groups. And we have a very great problem in northern Minnesota. I think Senator Zaksa can explain it better than I. I had three paper commies in my district, and he does too. And we watch now in Boise Cascade and other corporations who are selling land up. It's up for sale. They're on phase two now. And if we can pass this legislation with the Forest Legacy Account, we can make arrangements with these paper companies to identify lands that we can set aside that will not be sold, that won't interfere with snowmobile trails and access. And one thing we've had, all of us, over the years, you could come from outside the state and go north of Minnesota and hardly see a no trespassing sign. It's changing. And our kids are not going to have this opportunity. You go by International Falls, Grand Rapids, Bemidji, wherever. You could go anywhere. It's changing. And I would like to see our grandchildren have the same opportunity that we have. So that's why I'm trying to explain how important the Forest Legacy portion of this bill is. Because the reason I bring it up, I got a call this morning asking me to explain what does it mean. So I thought this is a good chance to do it. So thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I want to commend Senator for bringing this and bringing these the importance of our consul into this piece of legislation. So thank you very much.
Senator Lessard, having never worked with you, I was under the impression you were a quiet, soft-spoken man.
Well, Mr. Chairman, before I want to say one last thing. Suchere did a number on me the other day, and he said, and my very good friend Roger Moore, I think he'd agree with me on this one, he said, God bless Senator Moore, he opposed dedicating funding. And every time he looked at Senator Lessard, Senator Lessard would sit down. I think Roger Moore would be the first one to disagree with that one, because I never sat down because of anybody. I was going to call Roger and see if he'd refute that. But one thing I do is I never sat down.
Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate your passion, Senator. Senator Anderson.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I would just observe that a lot of legislators seem a lot sweeter after they leave the legislature.
Senator Ingebretson.
Of both genders or
yeah.
Only one side?
No,
thank you, Mr. Chair. And I would like to recognize as well Bob and former Senator Sams for working on this as many years as you did.
I should have mentioned, yeah.
It finally has come to hopefully not an end, but at least we're going to put it to the voters. Questions that I have, the council that you're talking about that we're dealing with today, is it the feeling of your group, I guess, and maybe both can be asked this, Roger as well, that you would like to see less legislators on there and more citizens? Is that where you're going with this?
Yes.
My understanding? Yes.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Lessard.
Senator Ingebretson, it's been a great I would say that there's people that are saying that only legislators should make this decision. You saw that, you've seen that no matter in other places, and I've always felt that that would be a hard argument to sell the public right now, that we are so great when we were sitting in the Senate, including myself, that we know everything. I do feel that the more stakeholders that you have on this bill, when it's finally presented to the public next November, the greater the chances you will have to pass it. Because they brought it to the table. This thing started out as a game and fish bill. And if you could just give them as much authority as possible to make the decisions. You know, there was the Arts Council used to do this, and they made all the decisions, and that went by for many years, and I never even noticed that till just recently. But so to answer your question, it's a long answer to a short question. I think that the more citizen membership you can make, the more participation and support you'll have. And never underestimate the intelligence, I think, that we have a tendency to do to some of the people outside of public office. There's a lot of people that I think are a lot smarter than me when I was in there, and I think that they could do a very good job.
Follow up, Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you. And the sweetness is there. However, the long answer still continues with legislators. Thank you very much. I will have to concur with the former senator with the feeling that I have out in my area with regards to the lottery. And I think those are legitimate complaints and legitimate issues. One of the first things that I looked into when I came down here last year and as to see where that money was going, and I was really quite astonished and kind of sad, if you will, to tell the folks that, to report to them that a huge chunk of that Minnesota lottery money was going into the general fund. And I think when the good senator says that he feels that feeling is out there, I think it's very legitimate. I really think that there's a little bit of a trust factor here with the public statewide as to they were under the impression that all that money was going to go to the environment. And, in fact, nearly $50 to $60 million last year alone or the year before went into the general fund. So I really feel that he has some strong points here, and maybe this question, if I can just finish with a question here, the Arts Board you talk about, I've not seen a number of folks who is this committee obviously is not going to deal with that.
Senator,
maybe that would be, I mean, they have an Arts Council that sees where the money goes, and is that going to be the same council that will be seeing the arts portion of this bill, or?
Mr. Chair and Senator Britson, like you said, we're not going to be dealing with the Arts Council and how the arts money will be spent in this committee. I don't think it'll be the same because this proposal is modeled at the after the LCCMR, but the Arts Council, to which the arts portion of the dedicated funding is allocated, is completely on its own. There are no legislators on it, and I think that's one of the one of the other reasons why the argument is for citizens to be involved with this. The heritage part is because the Arts Council is completely autonomous and it's all citizen based. We're just proposing that that it be a mix. So, albeit the Arts Council is getting far less money, it's only getting about $46 million as opposed to $91. But the point remains, they're getting an all-citizens council or board that will be distributing this money. And I think our proposal is modest in comparison.
Mr. Geschel, has MOHA taken a position on the makeup of the board?
As to the numbers, no. We think that we just want to see citizens represented on there, and whether it's 10 and 6 or 8 and 8, I don't really believe that we have taken a position other than we do want representation.
Senator Fredrickson.
And Mr. Chair, I would also add that, and members weren't here when I was explaining, I think the preference from sportsman groups is that citizens have a majority, and that's how this bill is laid out. But as I explained earlier, the most important thing is that we have that supermajority component in there, where whether citizens or legislators have the majority, it takes both sides to pass the ultimate recommendation. And then that whoever is in the minority, that it be a meaningful minority. So I don't want it to be one legislator as to 16 citizens or one citizen to 16 senators, legislators. So I think we've got a good balance here.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I want to make just a couple comments. First, the State Arts Board has been around since before I was elected to the Senate, and I've watched the appointments from governors from three different parties, and they've all made excellent appointments to that board, I feel. That board has operated very professionally and done a lot for the arts in Minnesota. And the money flows out to 11 regional councils that then makes smaller grants to a whole number of organizations in all of our individual Senate districts. So I want to make that comment about the Arts Board. So I would expect the money in here for the enhancement of the arts, the part for the Arts Council would go through that existing board because of their excellent record. Then I wanted to reminisce with Senator Lessard a little bit about the passing of the lottery and what happened with the funds for the lottery. As Senator Lessard has said before in this committee, that unbeknownst to those of us in this in the Environment Committee, when the bill went to the Tax Committee, the tax Committee imposed a 6.5% in lieu of taxes, which took 6.5% off the top of that lottery proceeds. And initially, as Governor Perpich proposed the lottery, and which we decided in the Senate, half was going to go to rural development for rural Minnesota and the other half to the Environmental Trust Fund. And that happened for a couple years. The Minnesota Rural Development part went to the Greater Minnesota Corporation, which was a citizen board, and within 2 or 3 years, the Greater Minnesota Corporation and their executive director had misappropriated so much money and made so many bad decisions that the legislature sunsetted that Minnesota Greater Minnesota Corporation and for Minnesota Technology Incorporated. All that money then went into the general fund. And ultimately, when we passed the constitutional amendment to dedicate the funds to the Environmental Trust Fund, the part for the environment was lowered to 40% rather than 50%, because primarily I think of budget restraints, and also because we needed money to pay off some pay for some bonds that were primarily environmental bonds.
Mr. Chairman, correct me if I'm wrong,
sir.
He's got a very good memory on this. It was 60-40, and then in a tax bill, it was raised 50-50, and I believe it or not, correct me if I'm wrong, and what it did, it took actually, it was like a 20% hit, but it was a 10% hit from the environment and went into the general revenue fund. Maybe you could explain that. That was done in a tax bill. Am I correct? I remember Senator Byrd got up on the floor, and he said, what's happening here? And we lost another 10%. It went from 50-50 to 60-40.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Lassard, this is going back a few years, but I don't think it was done. That was done in a tax committee. I think that was probably done in an appropriation bill to pay for the debt service on bonds that we sold for environment and natural resource purposes.
That just
the net result was we ended up with 40% rather than 50%.
Mr. Chairman, that point goes right back to the heart of it. Why the people have to... There was a lot of hard feelings on that, and that's why, again, I'll go back to the opening part of my statement, how important it is, I think, that we all know what we have, what we're going to vote for, and we have statutory language in place before. There are some that are saying, let's, who they are, probably not so much this body, say, let's pass the constitutional amendment and do the statutory language next year. That would be like giving almost $100 million to the general revenue fund. We had no idea where it's going to go. And that would be, I think, suicidal. So I think that's why the council is so important.
We've got lots to do today, committee. Senator Saxog?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, I'm under no illusions when I talk about northern Minnesota having an awful lot of the natural resources of the state that we're going to get a lot of representation. But I'd like to know how you people at the table visualize that we're going to get how the northern part of the state might end up with some geographical representation. On the LCCMR, there's one person in the northern half of the state, and so I'm just...
Mr. Chair, Senator Saxog, we do require that there be regional balance, I know for sure, in the Citizen Selection Committee. That is specifically set out. I don't recall if we say that the membership of the council have balanced geographical representation. I'm getting Mr. Knopf is shaking his head no. And I don't have a problem with that either, if we need to add that to provide more comfort to all parts of the state. I think that's good to do, too.
Follow up or move on?
Well, I appreciate that, you know, and I realize in a representative body that if you've got more deer than you do people and up in your district, you aren't going to have as much representation. But it is, I think, for the amount and the percentage of our natural resources up there, Mr. Chair, it's important that we get some people.
Let's think about an amendment if you want one, and let's take up some.
Got two more questions or senators that want to weigh in here. Senator Pariseau.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my comment was going to be about some of the things that Senator Fredrickson filled you in on the lottery, but recalling that people forget that, first of all, the payout takes a big chunk before anything else happens, and the second piece is that the administration of the lottery system itself and its office and staff are a piece that isn't taken into an account. And people thought 100% of the lottery proceeds would go to environment. It was never intended to be what they say they thought it was. It had some dedication, but it wasn't 100%. And so you have to take into account the fact that other dedication for the technical, what was the name of that company?
Minnesota Corporation.
Who thought that was going to become corrupt within 2 years?
Senator Stumpf.
Mr. Chairman, I was going to pass, but no, I'm still a little baffled as to what has happened to the 50% that has been set aside for the rural economic development. You know, it had gone to the Greater Minnesota Corporation, now into the general fund, but I think it's been a shortfall for Greater Minnesota. Even though it's kind of been washed over and said, well, some of it goes to WIF projects and some of it goes to other kind of natural resource projects, I still think that, that the original intent was good. When we passed that legislation, it was a way of stimulating economic growth for greater Minnesota and helping the environment. And we don't have that tool anymore. So I'm just saying that that's unfortunate.
Appreciate the, as we learned in education this morning, history does matter, but maybe to the bill for the rest of the afternoon committee. Thank you.
My comments on the lottery, Mr. Chair.
Senator Chaudhry.
Just a couple. First of all, I'd rather support the payment in lieu of taxes. Those PILT payments have provided needed relief to greater Minnesota communities that have a lot of their area in public lands. And, in my community, we enjoy most of our land. It pays property taxes. In Cook County, is it 80 or 90%? 95% of Cook County is in public lands. And so they very much depend on those payment in lieu of taxes. In fact, I would be an advocate. I'm not saying the lottery should be a source, but I'm an advocate for increasing payment in lieu of taxes. I think it's an important thing we need to consider. But just keep everything in context. Even if 100% of the lottery, including PILT, including administration, including prizes, all of that went to the, in some magical way, went to the environment, it would be dwarfed by the amount of money that dedicated funding is going to provide to habitat and water.
Others who would like to come to the table? Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Gary Leaf. I'm the Executive Director of Sportsmen for Change. I'll start right off and say exactly what dedicated funding is and could be for sportsmen, and that is unquestionably the most important sportsman's issue in the state. Now, the issue that this committee is going to be looking at is the most critical issue along the step before the voters decide on it next November. What we've basically done is around the state do around 30 to 40 different type of sportsmen town hall meetings. We regularly attend all the major events that sportsmen have. This weekend where we have a booth at the Deer Classic, and that's about 20,000 sportsmen attend that. So we give information on these issues such as dedicated funding and so on, but more importantly, we get it back on what their thoughts are. And without question, the sportsmen are very excited about the financial aspects that have been passed with dedicated funding and so on. However, as soon as you talk to them about it, their first question is, what has been mentioned is, okay, well, who's going to spend the money and where exactly is it going to go to? And in today's world with the 24/7 news cycles, internet technology, and so on, that information travels pretty quickly. So we've had a fair number of the outdoors writers that have been writing about the how critical this council is to sportsmen and the grants program and the forest account. And so they're going to be looking for this committee and other committees to answer that question. Okay, who is going to spend the money and where will it go? The other big piece with it is not just the council and the grants and the forest piece, but when. What sportsmen, in some examples we've seen, have been told that, well, we'll wait till next year. And essentially what that's telling you, or telling the sportsmen, is that you'll find out what you get after you pay for it. We're going to have to go from citizen to citizens to promote this bill. We don't need an election certificate to ask our fellow citizens. We need you to voluntarily tax yourself, increase taxes on yourself to pay for projects, hopefully conservation projects. In this instance, we're going out to the ballot. So it's a very serious matter when we have large collective groups, of sportsmen and clusters around the state that ask very similar questions. And it may seal the fate of dedicated funding one way or the other. To the degree that we can give them assurances and confidence and trust, the money's going to go to where it has been advocated for over the last 10 years, the higher level of participation we'll get. I think that the council, the clarity on the council and who comprises it and how it's spent, is probably worth thousands of volunteers that will get behind this. A grants program is, again, hundreds and, you know, thousands of volunteers who will work to get the word out. They won't be paid. You'll never hear their names. But what they do is they'll give a local sportsman's narrative on why this is important. Another reason is that when you consider sportsmen, in comparison to our population, we have the highest percentage of people that have hunt and fish in comparison to our population in the United States. Number one, almost one-third. About 32%, 31%. And when people hear about this, who they're going to go to is they're going to go to a lot of the sportsmen because they know of, and they're going to ask them what they think about it. And they say it's a lot of money, but we're, you know, uncertain exactly who's going to spend it and where it's going to go. The Conservation Partners Program brings tremendous clarity to that because everybody knows who all these different groups are. They've heard them all before, the Minnesota Deer Hunters or National Wild Turkey Federation or Ducks Unlimited or Pheasants Forever, and they've also heard of the local Sportsman's Club and so on. And what sportsmen want is local control. They want to see actual projects. They don't want to see bureaucracies. They don't want to see the money going to the DNR. They want to see local projects. And what that grants program would do is allow the local sportsmen volunteers to raise money so they can do local habitat projects and actually get the community engaged, as one group said. They've seen it in projects. So that'll be critical. But again, it's really, we need those things, we need those tools now. You know, it was mentioned about the KSDP poll and the effect that it had. I think something like 32% of the public said they'd support a tax increase that was for the outdoors and the arts, and some 60% were against it or whatever it was. Then we need even, it's even more imperative that we can get every sportsman we can behind this, and the council will definitely do that. The grants program will definitely do that because it's very understandable. It's for people who will raise money locally, and then they'll do local projects. The forest issue that was mentioned is critical because in Brainerd North and a lot of the spots like that, they've never had a serious habitat project or problem. And now they don't get CRP. But now they're starting to see the sell-off of a lot of these different forests, and it's disrupting a lot of things. So we need an emergency or an accelerated aspect to dedicated funding that deals right with their hot button issue right at the time when it's needed, because a lot of this stuff will be gone. It'll be sold for forever, and they're seeing it right before their eyes. And lastly, I think the biggest thing on it, whether you voted for dedicated funding in its current version or against dedicated funding in its current version, I think it makes a lot of sense and that the legislature could score a huge victory. This is a very big deal to sportsmen, a huge victory by including clarity on a Sportsman Stakeholders Council and pass it this session before we have to pay for it and then find out later with something else. We'll know for sure what we're going to get before we pay for it, that it has the council and the grants and the forest account.
Questions for Mr. Leafs? Senator Olson.
Well, maybe just a comment, but I think it's important to remember that while the legislature passed it and made it possible for the citizens to vote on it, it's going to be the people out, the citizens that are out there that are going to sell this. It's going to be their job. It's not. We are not going to be the ones doing that. The ones with their right out there amongst folks are the ones that are going to convince them that this is important and bring it to reality. And I think it's only legitimate that they have a strong voice in that distribution as well.
Senator Olson, although I believe philosophically, if they look at how we are planning to structure something, may help sell it.
Precisely, make them more committed to doing that selling as well.
Thank you,
Mr. Leaf.
I think
that's important.
Welcome to the committee.
Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lance Ness. I'm the president of the Fish and Wildlife Legislative Alliance. I'm also the co-chair of the Rally for Conservation, commonly known as the Duck Rally. And just make a couple comments and some thank yous, too. First of all, I want to thank the committee, and in particular Senator Saugrey, for bringing this forward. And I wish my friend Dallas Sams was here to see this today. So, and he was, by the way, the first senator to actually get this bill passed all the way through the Senate. And Senator Sard tried many, many times to do this. So they all deserve credit, all the authors, both parties, the bipartisanship that's made this a success at this point. Again, back to Senator Chaudhry's bill. I'm going to kind of echo some of the thoughts of the previous testimonies. There are some very important points in here, and among them is this Citizens Council. We would prefer to see it all citizens. We have no problem with that. I know that last night I seen several of you at a Ducks Unlimited banquet, and Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever, Wild Turkey Federation are all run by private citizens. They do conservation projects all across the country. They do it very well. They do it without controversy. They're quite capable of handling thousands and millions of dollars. They do it for a living. We can do this too, given the proper authority to do this. Having said that, I realize that the legislature would like some input in this and like to have some legislators sitting in that board. We are concerned about the size. We think 16 is a little large. In all our polls and all our studies that we've done have indicated that smaller is better than larger. It works better. So just having said that, we think 16 is a little bit large. But, again, we support the bill as it stands at this point. We have some concerns in particular. I know Senator Saxhog is very concerned about the forest legacy. The 20% seems to go on for all 25 years. And I was just questioned as if that was absolutely necessary. If it wasn't necessary, we'd like to see perhaps that if any unexpended funds go put back into the general account to be used in other places or for other needs that may arise. We have no clue what may come up in the next 25 years. Other problems may arise. Towards the back of the
Mr. Ness,
yes.
For a moment, I think we could have Mr. Knopf heard your request and would just like to that point.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that this is not constitutional language, so the legislature could make adjustments in that. They could also, if there were needs in other areas and that account had more than was necessary for acquisition of forest lands or easements, they could transfer money over. I mean, the legislature would still have the authority to make changes in that over the 25 years.
Mr. Ness.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Knopf. I do understand it is statutory. So, and then finally, towards the end, we see there's an administration fee, but we don't see a percentage. And so we're under the assumption that 97% is invested in the fund, and that would leave 3% for administration. I just wanted to make sure that was the understanding of the committee. And again, we want to thank Senator Chaudhry and all the other authors that have brought this thing forward, and we hope that you will vote in favor of this.
Questions for Mr. Ness? Senator Saxhog.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to clarify, Mr. Ness, what I understood is that at one point I thought 25% of the habitat was going to go to forests, and we're at 20 now, and so.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Saxhog, in our computations, as we tried to get to that 100 million, we had envisioned 25 million a year going for forest legacy, which I think is about where you're at.
Senator Chaudhry, to Mr. Ness's question on administrative costs, do you understand what his concern, and do you concur that what he sees is what he sees?
I'll defer to Mr. Knopf. We usually do have some administrative fee. Don't we usually have a percentage in there? Didn't last year's bill have a percentage?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Knopf,
Senator Chaudhry, this is the same percentage that's been in here for quite a number of years now. I think former Senator Lessard was instrumental in getting the 97% in. For the stamps and the surcharges and game and fish fund, but generally there's 90%. This is a higher standard. It's going to say that 97% has to be spent on specific projects on the grounds, so that the other 3% is available for administrative, not that it has to be spent on administrative parts, but it's available for that. So this would require that at least 97% of the money be spent on the ground.
So we do make 3% available.
Mm-hmm. Up to 3%.
Up to.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Okay.
Other questions? Senator Saxhog.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have an amendment when you're ready.
I think we're ready.
Do we have any other witnesses?
Any other witnesses that would like to speak for or against? Senator Saxhog, to your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Chaudhry, this is you and I, or you just deferred to me in terms of a geographical mm-hmm. representation amendment. And on line 2.22, I defer to Mr. Knopf. He has an amendment that we'd like to add.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Knopf.
Senator Saxhog is moving to amend on line 2.22 after the period. Insert. Appointing authorities shall consider geographic balance in making appointments under this section.
Okay.
Line 2.22.
After the period, Mr. Chairman.
Would you repeat the amendment?
Appointing authorities shall consider geographic balance in making appointments under this section.
Senator Chaudhry, are you comfortable with that
sounds
language?
Good.
I would move that amendment, Mr. Chair.
Amendment has been moved. Are we all clear on what we're voting on?
Mm-hmm.
Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make just kind of a footnote comment to the discussion we had about the payment of lieu of taxes that was imposed on the lottery tickets when the lottery was instigated. We said that that payment in lieu flowed into the general fund, which was true for a few years, but about four or five bienniums ago, that was changed so it goes into the Environment Finance Division that now Senator Anderson chairs. And that money is used for parks and trails, for fish and wildlife habitat, and for zoos. So that 6.5% now is being used essentially for the purpose, I think, that people intended it to be. But it does not go into the Environmental Trust Fund. It's appropriated directly.
72% of it.
About
72%.
72%, Mr. Knopf tells me.
Senator Chaudhry, I'm hearing at this committee that maybe someday someone could come and re-educate us on what happens to our lottery funds. And then we would have a clearer idea of where we're going. I appreciate that. Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question of whoever, I guess. 3% of this fund comes out to how much money and how many people are we looking at here, just so everybody has an idea of who we're going to hire to administer this. I mean, what's the process there?
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, up to 3%. We don't say 3% for administration. We say up. We say 97% has to go to the habitat. So that leaves up to 3% for administration. What happens is that the Legislative Coordinating Commission will kind of starts and gets the ball rolling, and then the council can decide who and how many people it wants to hire. Staff people. That's what happens with the LCCMR right now.
Sure.
The Legislative Coordinating Commission is an important coordinator of that process, but ultimately is for the council or the commission at the moment to decide, and so too would it be for this council.
All right, thanks.
Senator Chaudhry, where do you want to go with this?
We need to send it to finance.
State and
local government, I guess, is where the next stop would be.
All right. So
would you
I'll
like
move.
To make the motion?
That Senate File 3488, as amended, be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
To the motion. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Senator Chaudhry, do you want to take Senator Sandham next, or do you want to? Everybody else is on the committee that is here. But
here, yeah.
Senator Sandham, if you'd come to the witness table, please. And members will be looking at Senate File 3057. Senator Sandham, thank you for your patience this afternoon. And welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the opportunity to be here today and to discuss with you Senate File 3057. 3057 actually has had a couple of lives. I first became involved in this, and by the way, this is maybe what would be otherwise called a shining bill. First became involved in this in 2006 with a phone call from my good friends in southeastern Minnesota involved in what we call the Bluffland Whitetail Deer Hunting Group, and they had been involved in discussions within their organization relative to shining. And we put together a bill last year that we did introduce. It didn't get a hearing, but we played around with it a little bit in terms of an audience, and we realized that bill wasn't ready. And so what we did during the interim then was to begin to take that bill, polish it up, make it, if you will, session ready. And just before session, we had a bill, I think, that as far as I knew was all hands on deck. Let's go ahead, let's introduce it, and let's run with it. So this is a shining bill, has to do with shining light, artificial light to locate animals. A lot of folks have been involved, as I mentioned, and what I think I'll do at this point is turn it over to Gary Botzik here, and Gary will review the bill. I've got some folks from the Blufflands group here, and they can comment as well, and we can have discussion.
Great. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Botsick.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Gary Botsick, Executive Director for the Minnesota Conservation Federation. At the same time, the Bluffland Whitetail Association was concerned about the issue of artificial light. My Conservation Federation was in the process of passing a resolution in September of 06 that addressed me to talk to the legislature about fixing the or modifying, amending the artificial light statutes as well. Their concern, this came out of Lewiston Sportsman's Club, one of these sportsmen's clubs that's going to be eligible for $250,000, by the way, under the pass bill you just passed, so thank you very much. But we're not talking high-definition TVs either on the wall. But Mr. Chairman and Madam Chair, their concern in Lewiston was artificial light shining that was occurring in cattle yards, spooking the cattle, scaring the animals to the point where they would break fences and cause havoc to their owners. So there's a lot of activity associated with the so-called shining, two types of shining, poaching-type shining and recreational-type shining. And I think you'll be educated on that a little bit today. So, Madam Chair, this bill is a product of the legislation that the good senator introduced last year. We had two meetings with the interested parties, including the Bluffland Whitetail Association, the Conservation Federation, Minnesota Deer Hunters, and others, met with four conservation officers, including Pat Watts, who's here today at the department, and went over the legislation that was introduced last year and came up with this new bill. And this is a new introduction as compared to a strike everything. Basically, there's only three subdivisions to it. We took the opportunity to recodify, and Greg Knopf helped us with this, drafted this bill, in fact, or helped Cindy, Revisor's office, draft this. But basically to recodify, because over the years there have been so many exemptions and Band-Aids and rubber bands attached to these provisions, we felt it was appropriate to try to clarify some of that. So you'll see all of the exemptions have been moved out of Subdivision 1, Subdivision 2, and are now wholly existing in the exemptions or Subdivision 3. And we'll get to that in a second. Subdivision 1, as it relates to artificial lights to locate animals, that's the provision that deals with firearms and bows. There, right now it's illegal to use artificial light with a firearm and bow. We're not changing that. The only changing that we're attempting to do there, Madam Chair, is to eliminate the uncased gun. And that is, you see, being eliminated. That's mainly because of the changing layout of a vehicle, that it's a lot easier to get to. You don't have a trunk anymore. You can get to your gun or unstrung bow way too easy. So this is being eliminated, which means it stays in the case. It needs to be in the case. There are no hours, there are no seasons as it relates to shining with firearm or bow. Where you get into a little bit stickier situation is in Subdivision 2. This is without firearms. And if you look there, Madam Chair and members, there are a number of, there's three hourly provisions in there in under current law and one seasonal restriction. First thing we do is eliminate the season, September 1 through December 31st. So whatever we are attempting to do here, Madam Chair, would be year-round, not limited to deer season, which is September 1 through the end of the year, depending on the type of deer hunting activity. But make it apply year-round. It's more easy for folks to understand. It's also designed to help the conservation officers enforce the law. So it's a two-prong effort that we're trying to do, Madam Chair and members, to help the COs as well as make it clearer to the folks that are out there trying to hunt deer or even watch deer, Madam Chair. Subdivision 2, we are the biggest change that I see in this legislation is the changing of the 10 o'clock provision, 10 a.m. to 6 a.m. Provision, and eliminating that and inserting the new language that says from 1 hour after sunset until sunrise. So that, Madam Chair, is a substantial change, but we feel a necessary change that will allow recreational shining for wildlife, predominantly deer, but other animals too, for a half an hour after sunset, and that's it. If you look further in subdivision two, it breaks down this way. The first, the A, is, deals with wildlife or wild animals. The B relates to agricultural lands. And C, the old C is gone. The new C deals with residential. And the Blufftail Whitetail Association will talk to you a little bit about some of the problems that are occurring in residential areas. I think you've probably all heard or had complaints, at least the folks that are in the in Rochester or outstate Minnesota, as folks, the deer population has grown and has begun to migrate back into the suburbs, and all of a sudden the lights have followed. And these are not your grandpa's Coleman lanterns anymore that we used to use to take excessive fish out of the rivers. That's a whole other story, but we won't get into that today. I think statute of limitation applies too, by the way. I hope.
Excuse me, Mr. Bosick. Is this true confessions? Or?
Mr. Chairman, I was just trying to do the Coleman lantern thing. I should have used something else. These are high-powered candlelight lights. I think you know what we're talking about. These aren't. It does apply to car lights. It does apply to an artificial light that you might have on the side of your car, like a police officer has. But it also, there are some pretty heavy-duty, high-candled lights that are being used. And I hear the analogy once in a while, it looks like an airplane landing on your gravel road. I mean, that's a heavy light. And that's scaring people. That doesn't scare just cattle or horses. It scares people. If you're home alone, or if your spouse is home alone, or your kids are home alone, it can scare people. And that's what we're trying to address here, and try to tighten this artificial shining in that regard. That's the recreational shining in sub three. So if your questions are wild animal, they're related to section A, in subdivision two, section A. B is agricultural land, C, residential land. And then finally, the exemptions, as I mentioned earlier, are all now in sub three. There's the raccoon provisions, there's the fox, coyote provisions. Senator Parasol, I'm sure you're looking at those relating to your bill. Those exceptions are not being changed. They're just being recodified into one place. Most importantly, if I might, Madam Chair, or Mr. Chair, to finish this off, if you look at 317, these are some pretty heavy-duty exceptions. This is where agriculture exemptions, whether it's a tractor, or maybe a person in a vehicle that's out looking for a lost cow or horse on his field, and it shines the lights to try to find that cow. He's in an agricultural pursuit, therefore exempt from shining and wouldn't be ticketed under this. It also applies to safety and emergency vehicles, as you would expect, normal vehicle operations and occupational. And that includes everything from the pizza delivery guy to somebody, a relative, trying to find the house number on a suburban situation. And then finally, Mr. Chair, under 319, the Outdoor Recreation Act there, this covers an example that was brought to me. What if you're setting up a camp or a tent situation for your kids in your backyard? This would be covered under outdoor recreation. So that, too, is exempted. So it's not our intention to catch more people in this net, but we're trying to make it clearer to the citizens of Minnesota that use artificial light or shouldn't be using artificial light, depending on what their motive might be, but then also to make it clearer and easier for the conservation officers out there that are trying to enforce the law.
Questions?
With that, I'll stand for. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Bosick?
Looks good.
Chair, I have, I'm sorry. Senator Dell.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bosick, do I understand that the way this is put together, I'm looking on line 3.8, hunt fox or coyote from January 1st to March 15th while using a handheld artificial light provided the person is on, and on all these things you've got to do. What about the time, what about the rest of the year?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dill, that's existing law already.
That's the season for fox.
That's the season, right? Senator Parasol is pointing out that's the season for that.
I did not think there was a season on coyotes.
Senator Dill. Mr. Bostic.
I believe there is, Mr. Chairman and Senator Dill. DNR can correct us if we're wrong, but this is the existing law just being recodified. No changes in the existing.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bostic, does that mean? What does that mean in relative to controlling predators? If you got coyotes taking down your livestock, how does this affect that?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Dill, I think under nuisance predators, I think you're, as a farmer or a landowner, eligible to take that animal out of its misery, so to speak. And I think Representative or Ed Bogus is here to address that. That would be considered a nuisance. Well, the City Council can help us, I suspect, too. A nuisance animal and could be eradicated, if you will.
Mr. Knopf, or do you want Bogus to?
Mr. Bogus can weigh in, but I just wanted to point out that if it's agricultural, it's carried. If you look at 3.17, carried any agricultural activities. So saving your livestock would be an agricultural-related activity. So it would fall under that exemption.
Safety, emergency response.
Yeah, and just to point out, I think what Mr. Bostic pointed out, the part you're looking at right now, if you look on the previous page, page 2, lines 2.3 through 2.9, you can see this is just a direct recodification of what was in existing law for this provision.
Senator Dill, follow-up?
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I'm still trying to process all of this. And I'm looking at line 3.18, 3.17. And something about carrying out agricultural safety, emergency response, normal vehicle operations, or occupation-related activities that do not involve the taking of wild animals.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, that preposition or whatever was supposed to only apply to the occupation-related activities. I suppose it could restructure the sentence to make sure that it does, but that was intended only to apply to that part of it.
Well, Senator Dill.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Knopf, is this what does this mean in terms of say in May of this year? I drive my pickup truck out into the field, and I see a coyote eating my sheep. Does that mean I have to get out on foot and be at least 200 feet away from my pickup before I can shoot it?
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, I think
things hiding under your vehicle.
I don't think Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill.
He's doing your animal.
I think the idea was that you wouldn't use 3.8, but you would use 3.17. But you do bring up an interesting point because 3.17 only applies to when you don't have a firearm in possession. So if you've got a firearm in possession, that could be a problem. But that's a problem under current law, too.
Mr. Bogus, can you weigh in on protection of farm animals and hunting regulations for just a moment, please? For the record,
Mr. Chair and members, Ed Bogus, DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife, and to Senator Dill, you're correct. There's no season on coyotes. It's a year-round open season with no shooting hours. The language that Mr. Knopf was referring to on lines 2.3 to 2.9 that's being recodified into another area was actually new language that was passed last year. It's never been legal to use an artificial, even though we don't have any closed shooting hours for coyotes, it's never been legal to use an artificial light to hunt coyotes. The only thing that's been legal to use an artificial light to hunt is raccoons under some very specified conditions that are in Senator Parasol's bill that's also on the agenda today. So last year was actually an expansion in the use of artificial lights to allow them for predator hunting at night under very restrictive conditions on foot, away from a vehicle, using a shotgun, not in a right-of-way, and so forth. So that's actually an expansion of the use of artificial lights that was passed last year. Prior to that, to hunt coyotes at night, it's basically been done by moonlight. So So this is just moving what was passed last year into another spot. But it's never been legal to use an artificial light for coyote hunting at night until last year.
Senator Dirdill?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Boggess, one thing that would be really handy is if you've got a predator problem and you've got a farm or ranch and you're doing your work out there, it would be nice to be able to have a loaded firearm in your pickup cab so you're ready.
Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair, I think the other body is going to require a report on uncased firearms and vehicles. So. maybe we'll have more information on that.
Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Right. Oh, boy.
No, I don't have any questions.
Okay. Back to you, Senator Sandrum.
Thank you, Chair, and I have got a couple of individuals here from Bluffland Whitetails that would like to provide some testimony.
Identify yourself for the committee, please.
Mr. Chairman and committee, I'm Martin Stubstead from Rochester, member of the Blufflands, and also been a sporting goods retailer for 31 years. So I say that for the fact that I'm in constant contact with sportsmen, bow hunters and gun hunters. I'd like to back up just for a minute what Senator Senjum was talking about as far as how the bill really got going. We did somewhat of an introduction last year. It got tabled basically also because Captain Jim Conrad from Enforcement had contacted me. This struck an interest with him, and he wanted to meet as a group to work this bill out. Glenn Heisey from Pope and Young, Pat Watts was there, Gary Botzik, Jim Conrad, Paul Kusky, Tyler Quant, both COs. We had a Rodman Smith, captain of enforcement from New Ulm. I don't remember his name, but we had a judge from Duluth, and Luke Cornicelli was there. And we had two meetings, and in the second meeting, Mark Johnson from Executive Director of MDHA was on phone line with us during our second meeting. When we finally had the final draft of this, it was pretty much a total commitment that the language that was written was accepted by all members on that committee at that time. Deer shining, whether recreational or with intent to poach, is slowly taken on a different content to the social or cultural setting. There was a time when many people gave deer shining a blind eye. It was considered okay to a degree because people had the misconception that someone was doing it to feed their family, or if they ate the deer, it was okay to take a deer this way. Times have changed, and Minnesota hunters are demanding change in the shining law. Hunters today put more and more emphasis on quality trophy animals. The time and money hunters put into the gear and hunting land in order to cultivate their chance on trophy or a deer in general is increasing to all-time highs. So where does the deer shining come into play with all of this? Today, conservation officers are not arresting people for deer shining that are out trying to feed their family, actually in extreme rare occurrences. What conservation officers deal with today in the realms of deer shining are three common occurrences. The first is the group of juveniles who think it is fun and exciting to go out and deer shine, whereas in this process, find it a challenge to try to kill one of the deer they shine. As an example, I brought an article that was in our Rochester paper, the Post Bulletin, about some youth that statistically were shooting deer. And this, I want to also say, this just doesn't happen in southeastern Minnesota. If any of you get the Minnesota Outdoor News and read the cuffs and collars, you can see constantly that it's a total state concern. Where was I? Thrill of shining, driving away. Then one or two deer are found dead on the farmlands. The next day, are often victims of the circumstances. The second trend conservation officers are seeing are in the rack hounds. These individuals are looking for the trophy deer antlers and don't care on how they get them. Deer shot and left to rot are often missing their antlers. Often these are sold as the monetary value of the deer antlers increase. The third situation officers find is one of the greed along with a touch of envy. Individuals so desperate to get a deer, desperate so they can brag along with the rest of their friends, that they go out to extreme lengths to get one. The ability to shine deer in Minnesota has always been an enabler for poaching deer. To even admit shining as a recreational activity between parent and child is an unacceptable activity. There are many acceptable activities a parent or mentor can teach a future hunter, like general woodsmanship, then sticking a spotlight out the window of the truck or shining fields with your vehicle, from your vehicle. Landowners and homeowners are tired of shiners shining their farm lots and into home windows. With more property being divided for housing, shining is a disturbing more people, and that the irritation turns that non-hunting citizen into an anti-hunter. Let's make things simpler. Remove shining in being allowed and cripple the deer poacher. This will help appease landowners, provide better protection for deer and for the poacher, from the poacher, and let conservation officers be more effective in catching the shining deer poacher, not having to answer to hundreds of complaints from landowners that are having their livestock spooked and not waking up at night thinking that they had forgotten to turn off the kitchen lights. The other question in mind was in the retrieval of a game animal after shooting hours. as it is right now, we would have up until 10 o'clock in the evening to recover that animal. If we are out at that time, past that 10 o'clock, it is then necessary to contact either a local conservation officer, a police department officer, or a sheriff's department to let them to be notified of what your intent is. This here really is only is kind of moving it forward a little bit by an hour or two by going to the 1 hour after sunset. So there really isn't much change at that time. I thank you for your time.
Questions for Mr. Stubstead? Senator Sandra?
And Mr. Chair, perhaps for some brief testimony, Kent Holland, also with the Whitetail Association.
Mr. Holland, please identify yourself for the record.
My name is Kent Holland with the Minnesota Whitetail Association. Thank you for having me, Mr. Chair and committee. I'm just going to touch briefly on land ownership rights. The composition of land ownership in our area in southeastern Minnesota has changed a lot in recent years, and I think throughout Minnesota, much of Minnesota anyway, maybe not southwest so much. But parcels are smaller. Land is getting fragmented. There are also a lot more leases in effect for smaller parcels of land. What's happened is the shining regulations in the past worked fairly well for farmers because farmers had large parcels of land. There were not nearly as many or as many close buildings one to the other. And also farmers have, for the most part, had fenced land. It has always been illegal to shine in fenced land containing livestock. Now, with many owners not being farmers, not generating their income from the land, and not having fenced land or livestock, they have no way of protecting themselves from shining. You probably all know, but you cannot legally post your land to stop people from shining. So now we've got a lot of new owners that have moved to the country for the sake of being gaining some privacy and some rights over the land that they're living on, and they can't stop people from coming and shining the land. The lights that are now available can be seen for 10 miles, as it says right on the box. In our area, shining one ridge, you might live by road 10 miles away, so it's really hard for a CO to get from one spot to another, but that light can very well be coming in your bedroom from that ridge over. So it's a continual frustration, and obviously it's leading to a great deal of poaching and other illegal activities, and so we would really like to see this restricted. So thank you.
Questions for Mr. Holland? Thank you for coming in today and testifying.
Mr. Chair, let me just conclude by offering that as I was initially contacted with respect to this bill and this idea, I did it on behalf of some truly wonderful sports persons, sportsmen and sportswomen of southeastern Minnesota, and I think they reflect a view of a lot of good sports people from around Minnesota. So I was happy to do that, am happy to do that. And hopefully, as you consider this, Mr. Chair and members, we can work towards an inclusion of this in your in your final omnibus bill.
Thank you, Senator Sandrum. We have more. Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Member Senator Sandrum, somewhere in here I'd like to try an amendment, maybe not today, but somewhere along the line. I'm a little bit troubled by the words and the problems in livestock operations where you do have coyotes that are killing and attacking livestock. And it looks to me like you've got this line here where there's 2.5 months where you can hunt coyotes, which we know whether you can hunt them all year long, but for 2.5 months you can use a light. But for the other 9.5 months you can't. And since they are a substantial problem in some parts of the state, I think it would be appropriate to expand this to allow lights to be used if your livestock are being killed or attacked by predators, including coyotes. I'm not sure which words to use, but I'd like to work with Mr. Vargas and you and others and figure something out before we get to the omnibus bill.
Senator Sandrum.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dill, I would be very happy to work with you on whatever the appropriate language is. We want to take care of you and your sheep and to make sure that all is well on the Dill Farm as well as farms across Minnesota.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Sandrum, one of the largest sheep producers in Minnesota, which is in southeastern Minnesota, I believe south of Rochester, contacted me within the last 10 days or so about his coyote troubles. So I'm thinking about him. I've got a lot of coyotes, too, but my coyotes, fortunately, prefer eating dead turkeys rather than my sheep.
And, Senator Dale, we've been trying to take care of that problem, I'll tell you.
Mr. Kelleher is at the table. Please identify yourself for the
records.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Tom Kelleher. I'm here representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. We are about 68 statewide chapters. We have a number of chapters in southeast Minnesota. Those chapters definitely share the concerns of the Bluffland Whitetails organization. A couple of comments in regards to the bill before you. Just one clarification. On page 2, in current law, you can post your property to not allow shining on your property.
Only if it's fenced.
Also, And I should start that the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association, about 10 or 12 years ago, along with the Farmers Bureau and the Farmers Union, worked to tighten up the trespassing and the shining laws. That's basically what's the current law before you. A couple of concerns that we have, and I just got off the phone with Mark Johnson, my executive director at the Deer Hunters Association, and I am speaking more or less on behalf of him. Our corporate board didn't have an opportunity to talk about this bill, which was last 2 weekends ago, and that's basically my fault because I didn't see this bill introduced last year. So let me just make a couple comments, and I'll be done. Under current law, there is the prohibition on shining during the deer seasons from September to December from 10 to 6. That's something that we wanted to have happen to alleviate and stop poaching. I should say on the poaching issue itself, with Senator Saxhog, I believe we're going to have an amendment to this bill to increase the fines for poaching because they have not been increased since the 80s, I believe is what Mr. Knopf told me. Also, it's current law that you cannot shine on fenced agricultural land, and it's current law that from 6 p.m. to 6 a.m. you can't shine on residential property or building sites. Because part of the concern 10 or 12 years ago when this first came up was the amount of burglaries and thefts out of outbuildings on farms where people were saying they're shining for deer when, in fact, they were shining for snowmobiles, toolboxes, and power tools and those sorts of things. We sort of like the structure of current law. I have talked to Mr. Botzik, the lobbyist for this bill, about trying to do some changes to current law, but not as drastic as what this bill before you does. We'd also agree to increasing the fines for illegal shining outside of these parameters that are on current law. And that also we believe that the 1 hour after sunset until sunrise window of opportunity to legally shine could be a problem in regards to retrieving game. That people shoot their deer at dusk and that it might take them more than an hour to find that downed game. And if they were using a light to do that, they would be shining. And there's all sorts of other examples of that I can bring up before the committee, but I'm sure you can all use your imaginations in regards to what other sorts of limitations this bill would do on the current practices of shining. and the former chair of the finance division of this committee, and I have shined on his farm property legally. So, I mean, you need to consider, I think, how restrictive this bill is in compared to what's current law, and that contrary to some of the statements that were made earlier, some people do like to shine deer legally that aren't hunters, and hunters as well.
Questions for Mr. Kelleher? Senator Dibble?
So I think Mr. Kelleher started to answer a question that's been in my mind since we started hearing this bill. And that is, you know, why any shining, you know, this 10 p.m. or hour after sunset, is the sole reason to be able to use to allow people to be able to use these lights is the location, or is there some circumstance where folks use shining for the purpose of taking a shot at a deer, or is that
Mr.
Kelleher?
I'm just not understanding why we allow it at all.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dill. If you're using a weapon and you fire it, you're poaching, whether or not they think even if you hit the animal or not. To answer, I think, your second question, why we allow it at all, some people just really enjoy shining. People that don't hunt like to get in their car and go out at dusk and shine and look at deer in fields while they're eating. As I said, I've done it with former Senator Sams on his farm. I think that's the last comment I'd make, too, is that this is on all land, public or private. And I think there should maybe be a distinction in regards to if you're on your own property, not poaching, of course. In regards to legally shining, some hunters like to scout the area they're going to hunt to see what type of game, big game, antlered deer, are on those properties so that the 4 or 5 weeks when the season comes up, they sort of know in a big plot of land where to go look and what they're looking for.
Senator Dibble,
fast version.
Where I live, it's deer heaven, and in October and November, it's a parade of slow-moving vehicles by my house with an occasional sweep of a light, and they're on the road, off the road, in the woods, out of the woods. I mean, there's recreational spotting that goes on.
Oh, I never knew that. That's interesting.
I'd be happy to take you shining, Senator Dibble, legally.
Any other
Huggers
questions?
Have to get their stockbrokers have to get their stuff.
Mr. Stubstead, did you want to weigh in on to that point?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Dibble. When we revised the shining bill, the first act of it was to eliminate shining entirely. Mm-hmm. We compromised for this to giving it 1 hour. So that was our total intent at the very beginning because lights are not needed to hunt.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other questions for the witnesses? Thank you. Mr. I'm going to get your name yet. Holen. Mr. Stubstead, I'd have you move the microphone toward Mr. Holen, please. Thank you.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, to the witness.
Mr. Kelleher.
If you look on page 2, if I'm reading this right, line 2.21, display reflectorized letters that are at least 2 inches in height that state no shining or similar terms.
That's only.
Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, that is only on fenced agricultural land that contains livestock or poultry.
Well, I mean, that's
the only opportunity right now for
Mr. Kelleher.
So I misread that statement, but I think the Deer Hunters Association would agree to making that for any property if a owner would like to post their property no shining. I don't think we'd have any problem with that.
And Mr. Chairman, if you look on 2.35, that's the new language to allow anybody.
I misunderstood.
Other question, Mr. Stubstead.
Not illegal to recover your deer after the 1 hour or after the 10 o'clock if you have given the intent of calling your CO, police department, or sheriff's department. It never has been and it never will be. This is one thing that our COs brought up in our meetings that we had that they have never, ever, out of the many years of being conservation officers, they've never fined somebody for the rescue of an animal. Okay, thank you.
Other questions?
Mr. Chairman, I would move...
Senator Paraso, would you like to move this bill?
For the discussion, I would move this bill, and would it go directly to the floor?
I think it's the chair's desire to put non-fiscal bills, Senator Paraso, into an omnibus bill for
not,
consideration.
It doesn't need to go to another committee. We're laying over all the bills for the omnibus.
Would you be willing to move that, Senator?
I'll move it, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Paraso moves Senate File 3057. Did it get amended? I don't remember. To be laid over for possible consideration in the omnibus bill. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Chair and members, thank you very much.
We want to. We've got Paraso and Fredrickson, and then you. Senator Paraso, would you like to go next?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I can do it right from here. Chairman,
Senate File 2877, Senator Paraso.
This very brief, this very brief bill is at the request from the Coon Hunters Associations, and it does just change the couple items there on page on point 1.6 and 1.7 to changing it from a half hour after sunset. And one half hour before sunrise, so it's a small change in the season limitations there. And the other limitations are in current law already. Being on foot and using an artificial light only if you hunt with dogs, and a rifle of .22 caliber only, or obviously a shotgun with shell no larger than number four, shell shot no larger than number four. That is the content of it and the sum of it. And so I would move it, Mr. Chairman.
Well, why do we need to do this?
I don't know if there's any if there's a coon hunter in the room, because I got this from there some time ago, and I don't even know who sent it to me, to tell you the truth. But the association is behind it.
Okay. We don't have an explanation as to why we need this.
For one thing, I think the coon have a tendency to travel by night because it's their cover. And often, many of the coon hunters are doing hound hunting, so the hounds are chasing them. They move quite a distance and cause a stir, and they typically end up in a tree. So I believe that it's probably has to do with as much light as available for the humans to see the animal wherever it's hidden. And been chased.
Okay. Does DNR have some thoughts on this?
We may.
Mr. Chair and members, Ed Bogus, DNR Division of Fish and Wildlife, and I'm not sure exactly what the impetus for this is, but what it does is it just adds half an hour on each end of the day when raccoons may be taken without being on foot and being restricted to a .22 caliber rifle or a shotgun with no larger than number four. So what it would, I think, I'm not sure that it would really affect the traditional raccoon hunters who are usually out with dogs and lights at night as much as it would open up hunting for, and I'm guessing there's a story behind this from some constituent somewhere, and it may have originated with a constituent of a House member, I'm not sure, but what this would seem to do is open up the ability to shoot a raccoon in that half hour before, half hour after, when maybe you're hunting deer or ducks or something like that. You might not have a .22 rifle. You might not have number 4 shot. You might have number 2 shot. You might have a deer rifle. Right now, you can't shoot that raccoon because you're not on foot using the .22 or number 4 shot. The restrictions in current law are designed to cover the situation where you're out at night with an artificial light, and I think maybe the rationale here is that half hour before and half hour after are really more dusk than dark, and you don't need a light at that time because you can still hunt deer and other species at that time without a light. So talked a little bit with our enforcement division. I guess we don't have any real issues with what Senator Perso is trying to do here. I'm not sure the need for it, but doesn't seem to create any significant problem as long as we maintain the darkness when they're using lights is what the current law is designed really to get at.
Senator Dibble.
I just want to make sure I'm reading the bill correctly. It sounds like it's a restriction, more of a restriction, and removing the period of time inward to after sunset and before sunrise. And I think that's what Mr. Bogus was. We're not extending it by an hour. We're shortening it by an hour total per night.
Okay.
Am I reading that right?
But Mr. Chairman, the key point that Mr. Bogus made is you're narrowing this period down, but you're expanding the period when you don't have to be on foot and use artificial light and the number 4 shot and all of that. So then during the remainder of the day, during the extra hour now, you're going to get each day, you're getting an extra hour when you don't have to follow these restrictions. You can take them through other means.
I see.
Okay, thank you. Okay. Raccoons.
So
a lot of them in my neighborhood.
Usually they're on the highway and been struck by
something. They live in my storm sewers.
All over the place.
So between sunset, a half hour after sunset, you don't have to be on foot, and you can use a higher caliber gun, and you can use larger shot.
Number 2. Mr. Chair, from a half hour before sunrise until a half an hour after sunset, once it's a half an hour after sunset, then you would be restricted to the .22 and the small shot. And not able to use a light unless you're hunting with a dog.
Okay. Is this brought up at the round table at all, the wildlife section?
Mr. Chair, I don't believe it was.
Coon Hunters Association ever attend? And at least?
Mr. Chair, they have in the past, but I'm suspecting this isn't coming from the traditional coon hunters that use the dogs and the lights. I think it's probably coming from someone who wants to be able to shoot a raccoon when they can be legally hunting other species without a light. But I don't know. That's speculation.
Senator Perso, it would be nice to kind of get an explanation where this is coming from, the reasoning behind it. And we've got time. We're going to lay this over for possible inclusion anyway.
Weeks, perhaps, or how long?
Pardon?
Weeks or how long, Mr. Chairman?
Today is Wednesday. No, a week.
I'll try to get more information, Mr. Chairman, but I'm not certain that I can reach someone because I don't have aren't on my list of regularly called. So.
We just don't want to do anything that does something that we don't know about in coon hunting. If I was a experienced coon hunter, I might be able to offer some thoughts, but it'd be nice to hear from the people who know what they're doing. But at the moment, we don't see a problem with it. So anything further on that, Senator Perso?
Not from me, Mr. Chairman.
Senate file 288077 is laid over for possible inclusion. Senator Fredrickson. Fredrickson, Senate File 3246.
Good
Mr. Chairman, I have from the Department of Natural Resources Mr. Jim Japs with me also, and we'll try and work our way through this bill and adequately explain it, and of course we'll answer any questions you may have about it. Senate File 3246 would allow the Department of Natural Resources, when they're dealing with infractions of law in the area of waters, to use administrative penalty orders to entice individuals to comply with our water laws. Now what the department basically has is they can ask the violator to stop the violation and restore the infraction, or they can take them into court, issue them a citation, take them into court, and use the judicial system. What an administrative penalty order does is give the department a different method of forcing compliance or compelling compliance with the state laws. You can see on Section 1, the chapters that this would affect would be Chapter 84, which is a general DNR law, and it would cover aquatic plants. 103F is the protection of water resources, and 103G is waters of the state. And you can see this would be used when there's activity affecting the forest, current, or cross-section of public waters, appropriation, or division of waters of the state, or harvest control or destruction of aquatic plants. Mr. Chairman, members, the other agencies have this authority: Board of Water and Soil Resources, Department of Ag, Pollution Control Agency, to name some. So that's the reason for the bill and the scope of the bill. I'll, as quickly as I can, as quickly as we can, go through the details of the bill. Section 2 is the procedure for issuing an administrative order. An order assessing an administrative penalty has to include a concise statement of the facts, reference to the law, rule that may be violated, statement of the corrective order and the amount of the administrative penalty to be imposed, and a statement of the person's right to review the order. And subdivision 2 are some considerations to be taken into account in determining the amount of the penalty. You can read those. I'll list a couple: the willfulness of the violation, the seriousness of the violation, plus three or four more. Paragraph B under sub 2, if there are subsequent violations, delineates what would be taken into consideration in issuing a penalty for a subsequent violation. Subdivision 3 is the commissioner's authority to issue a corrective action, and that certain things have to happen before 31 days elapse as a result of that corrective action. I think to explain how this would work, I had distributed a diagram to each of you. I think that's probably the best way to explain what's in the bill. And this is something that my staff, Wendy Havistow, and I developed. Administrative penalty order is issued. That is at the top. After that order has been issued, the violator has 30 days to respond. And the respond might be just to comply with the administrative penalty order. That would be box 1 over on the left. The penalty is payable and the corrective action is taken. They've restored the wetland or whatever it is. And the commissioner may then respond with forgiving the penalty or reducing the penalty or doing something like that. The alleged violator also could, within that 30 days, request an expedited hearing from the Office of Administrative Hearings, and that's on the right. And the Office of Administrative Hearing would have to hold a hearing within 30 days of the request, unless the parties would mutually agree to a later time. And the Commissioner of Natural Resources would have to give 15 days prior notice before that hearing is held. Then after that hearing is held, the administrative hearing officer would issue a result, a recommendation, within 30 days of that hearing. after the administrative law judge makes that ruling or that recommendation, the Commissioner of Natural Resources would have to wait 5 days before implementing the results of that recommendation. And during that 5 days, the respondent or the violator would have opportunity to make comment as to the administrative law judge's decision and recommendation. After that, the violator would have 30 days to pay and take corrective action. That is what the violator chose. Or an alternative is they could ask for judicial review by the State Court of Appeals, and that is an expedited review. And that's according to 14.63 to 14.69. And at the conclusion of all of this, the violator would have 30 days to pay the penalty and take corrective action. Mr. Chairman, that's the kind of the time flow of this section of the.
Okay,
I'm going ahead in the bill here to. There is also another way to settle the dispute on page 4, subdivision 6. If the commissioner and the alleged violator chose, they could choose under subdivision 6 an alternative dispute resolution to settling the dispute. Rather than using the process laid out in this bill, they could go to mediation or other alternative dispute resolution procedure. A subdivision 7 allows the Attorney General to enforce the penalties and also eventually to go into court to compel the compliance with the order. And subdivision 8, if a person fails to pay the penalty owed under this section, the commissioner may revoke or refuse to issue a permit, license, or registration issued by the commissioner. Subdivision 9 is a cumulative remedy, and among other things, that the state may not seek civil penalties, any other provision of law for the violations covered by the administrative penalty order. Skip back for a second just to page 3. And if an administrative law judge issues a report that recommends dismissal of the order assessing the administrative penalty, the commissioner must refund the cost charged to the person receiving the order by the Office of Administrative Hearing for the hearing and reasonable and necessary attorney fees incurred by the hearing. That would be the state paying the individual violator. On the other hand, if it was found that the violator violated something that was proved to be willful, the state could ask for some of its costs to be paid. So it could go either way. Section 4 requires the Commissioner of Natural Resources to prepare a plan for implementing this administrative penalty order, and that is as per the recommendation in all these cases of the legislative auditor. Mr. Chairman, members, I went through the bill fairly quickly. I do have a couple small amendments, one-word amendments, when you're ready to do that.
Okay. Do you want to go to your witness or your amendments?
I guess we're at this point of, do you have any questions?
Will there be sufficient notice to the recipient of the order of their right to appeal?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there would. I think that's a pretty standard process. But I'll let Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Jim Jaffs. I'm the Assistant Director for DNR Division of Waters. And in Section 2 of the bill, Subdivision 1 has the contents of the order. And at line 2.1, there's a statement of the person's right to review the order. And that would include the ability to request an expedited hearing.
What form does the request for an expedited hearing take?
Is it an application?
Is it a form? I'm thinking of small claims court. You receive a decision, but you have the right to take it to district court. you're automatically provided a form to fill out and send in if you're requesting that it be removed to district court. Will they receive the same thing in this process?
Mr. Chair, we do not have a form for that. All it takes is a simple letter, and it's usually one or two sentences.
Okay. Is that will that be clear in these orders?
Mr. Chair, that's clear with all of our permits and things, yes.
On how to request that hearing?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. Other questions? Don't see any.
Mr. Chairman, I would have a couple one-word amendments I would like to make.
Okay.
Page 2, line 34, delete may, insert must. And you'll see the commissioner finds certain factors. The commissioner then must forgive in whole or part the penalty. The commissioner still has large discretion to find whether or not they have complied with the order. And if the person has complied, I think we should say, yes, the penalty has to be repaid. And page 5, 6, at the end of the sentence, the word finally, delete finally and put ultimately. I just don't like the sound of finally. I like
Page five, line six.
Everybody understand the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, can I just make Senator Frederickson on your on 2.34, changing may to must. I was just looking at the Pollution Control Agency's administrative penalties, and in there they don't have the in whole or in part. It just says that the penalty must be forgiven, as long as the commissioner's made the determination. And so I didn't know if you wanted to still leave the in whole or in part in, or just say that must be forgiven if they satisfied the commissioner's if the commissioner's determined that's been corrected, or the person whom the order is issued has developed a corrective plan acceptable to the commissioner, whether you want to just say it must be forgiven or must be forgiven in whole or in part. Again, for the Pollution Control Agency, which this language is modeled after, it just says it must be forgiven.
Mr. Chairman, I would add to my motion to amend then on page 2, line 34, delete may, insert must, and delete everything after forgiven to the period.
What if the person doesn't follow the corrective plan?
Then they would, Mr. Chairman, they would still be in violation, and the penalty would not be forgiven.
But if the commissioner approves a corrective plan, then you have to. It doesn't say here you have to wait for that plan to be implemented. Do you want to say if the person has developed a corrective plan acceptable to the commissioner and has been implemented?
Mr. Chair, sometimes there's a timing issue there, and if we weren't sure that we're going to implement that, we would have that concern, and we may have to go through the process again. Usually do gain compliance at some point. You have a valid concern. It just doesn't happen there.
Okay.
And I would move that amendment.
On the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion on the bill. Local government need to see this?
Judiciary, Mr. Chairman.
Judiciary.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move that Senate file number 3246 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the committee on judiciary.
Everybody understand the motion? All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed. Motion prevails.
Sorry, I was looking out the window.
That's a little confused.
It must be something apart.
So a gala?
Yeah. Is that a legal comment or a medical?
Both. Good answer.
Thank you very much.
You say it depends.
Members, we have one left yet today, and that is Senate File 3425, Senator Chaudhry's Game and Fish Provisions Modification Bill. Senator Chaudhry.
Chair, this is a continuation of yesterday's discussion on the Omnibus Game and Fish Bill. We wanted to offer an amendment that deals with the work DNR has been doing regarding streamlining of our deer hunting regulations. And I think at this point it would be appropriate to pass it out.
While it's coming around, do you want to start in on it, Senator Chaudhry? Or?
Yes, we've got a handout as well that summarizes it. I'll leave the explanation to Mr. Bogus.
Welcome back, Mr. Bogus.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Ed Bogus, DNR. And what we'd like to talk about, the amendment that we'd like to talk about, I do have a couple of handouts that will help to explain it if we could get those distributed. But it relates to a deer simplification process that Commissioner Holston had asked us to go through, and we assembled a small group, a cross-section of deer hunters, landowners, and they met a couple of times over the course of December and January to look at our deer hunting regulations and try to come up with some recommendations on how to simplify some of the complexity that's developed kind of piecemeal as we've added licensing options and zone options and limit different types of limits in different types of areas and so forth. And what's being distributed to go along with the amendment language is an executive summary of the deer simplification report with some recommendations and a kind of a flow chart of how things work now, which is the messy looking thing, and how we'd like to kind of change them, which is the cleaner looking thing on the back. But I have Mr. Lou Cornicelli with me today, who is our big game program consultant and who worked with this group and works on our deer regulations. And may I just ask him to explain the four basic recommendations that came out of this group that would require action by the legislature. And the reason that this language was not in the original bill was this group was still meeting in January when we were putting our proposed game and fish bill together, and we've only recently been able to come up with the actual language to accomplish these recommendations. So we're asking that we be able to amend these into the larger bill today, but with the chair's indulgence, if I could have Mr. Cornicelli just explain the recommendations that the language is trying to implement.
Mr. Cornicelli, identify for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, Lou Cornicelli, Minnesota Department of Natural Resources Division, Fish and Wildlife, Big Game Coordinator.
Welcome to the committee. And
thank you.
It's all yours.
In December and January, we had 13 stakeholders assembled to go over our deer regulations, and we did so asking them to look at them objectively and not come with any preconceived notions of what things should look like, nor did we give them any hints as to what we thought they should look at. They came on this of their own volition, and they made some good recommendations, and I thank them for that. There's four recommendations in front of you on this executive summary. The ones that are in the statute, proposed statute, are actually 1, 2, and 4 on these numbered lists. And starting, the number 3 is, I'm sorry, 1, 3, and 4. Number 2 is, it would be a rule issue that we're currently looking at. But 1, 3, and 4 are in the statutes that we're asking to amend. Number 1 would be consolidate the number of deer licenses that we have. Deer hunting goes back in this state to about 1900 officially. And over the course of that time, we've added a lot of licenses, grown deer populations, liberalized how we can harvest deer, and you've got the chart that you see today, this thing here. That's our current license structure just for adults with three different types of parent licenses and three different types of permit areas. And we have an all-season license where it comes with three tags, but you can't use all the tags in all areas of the state. So this group made a recommendation to basically streamline how we issue licenses in Minnesota for deer hunting. Currently, you can't buy a firearm and muzzleloader season license unless you buy an all-season, which gets confusing. So the committee made a recommendation to actually, on the back of this, just let a hunter buy all three licenses. We'll set the bag limits by permit area. So when you buy a license, you know what the bag limit is for that permit area. You're not issued a license that has three tags that you can't use. And basically put the onus on the hunter to know what the bag limit is, where they're hunting, and just let them buy a license. So it dramatically simplifies it from that perspective. But it does ask to eliminate the all-season and the multi-zone buck license, which we currently have contributing to this spaghetti chart there on page one. Number three, we have a regulation to validate the deer license at the site of kill that was instituted in 2006. In meeting with this team and speaking with our law enforcement division, we could probably do away with that because we'd like to preserve site tagging that we currently have, and there's no real issues with that. So just eliminate the new license tagging that was started in 2006. It's a minor notch that you have to put on your license that very few people actually do. And then finally, simplify the legal calibers that we have in this state. We have probably one of the more complex explanations of what you can use to go deer hunting. It starts off with 23 caliber or greater, 1.285 inches or larger, expanding bullet, and then we've got a whole bunch of exceptions like the 30 carbine, the 10 millimeter auto. What we're suggesting is just say 22 centerfire or bigger. That would bring us in line with five of the upper Midwestern states that hunt with rifles. South Dakota has, Michigan, Missouri have no restriction. They just say centerfire rifle. Wisconsin, North Dakota rather have 22 center fire, and South Dakota has an energy restriction. So basically, we'd be doing what all the other states around us are doing with respect to center fire rifles.
Mr. Carnicelli, do you have any testimony as to the number of injured or maimed animals on a 22? Are we going to see less kill and more wound?
Mr. Chairman, no, I don't believe so. Having come from out west where we do hunt deer with 22 center fires, there's really no difference in wounding loss between a high-velocity light bullet and a low-velocity big bullet. It's really shot placement and bullet selection. So it's our impression that hunters will know what kind of bullets are best for the animal they're hunting and make the appropriate decision. But there's really no data out there to show that size of bullet influences wounding loss. It's really shot placement and bullet type.
And Mr. Chair, just to make it clear, this would not allow the 22 rimfire, right. Even the 22 Magnum. It would have to be a center fire, which does have considerably more energy. And just to piggyback a little bit on Mr. Cornicelli's point is that there's some cartridges now that are legal that don't have real good ballistics. Certainly this would legalize some cartridges that don't have real good ballistics, but the philosophy of a lot of our surrounding states has been that the deer hunters can sort those things out. And it isn't, rather than trying to, if you look on our website, we've got a two-page list of what's legal that we know of, and some of the ones that aren't legal. It's just gotten to be very complicated to know what's legal and what's not legal, and we just think we need to leave some of this to hunter discretion, and they need to take a little bit of accountability to look at the ballistics of what they're using and figure out what works and what doesn't. So it's a simplification. Does it legalize some things that aren't real great? Yes. It also legalizes some that are better than current statute ballistically. So that's the idea behind it.
Thank you, Mr. Bogus. Mr. Carnicelli, back to you.
Mr. Chairman, that's all I would have for the changes. I can answer any questions you might have.
Questions for the witnesses or for Mr. Carnicelli?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bogus or Mr. Carnicelli, is there a plan to put this diagram in the regulations? It's very helpful.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, there would be, we'd probably have something along those lines in the book, whether it's a flow chart or a detailed explanation. If we were to adopt the recommendations of this group, it would dramatically simplify how we explain things. So, yes, we would likely put something like that in there. We do publish a larger flow chart for buying a license that's helpful, but we could do this in the regulations book, yeah.
I think the flow chart, would be very helpful. I mean, a picture says 1,000 words. So this would clear up a lot of, along with what you're saying.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, I know that one of the recommendations that didn't require legislative action was to look at how the information is presented in the regulations book kind of comprehensively, and it's also been kind of built piecemeal, so that's a good suggestion to look at things like charts and graphs or things like that. I would just also, one thing that Mr. Corselli didn't mention, that because it's something that we could do by rule, but the back of the handout that has the maps on it just illustrates that even if we consolidate the licenses and get rid of the all-season, the multi-zone buck, what we're talking about is really an a la carte kind of a system where you can buy an archery license, a muzzleloader license, or a firearms license, and or any combination of one or two or all three. But we would also propose to go from the map that's on the left to the map that's on the right, which would allow you to use those licenses for firearms hunting essentially statewide, but with different lengths of seasons in different parts of the state. So you'd still have the ability to cross the zone boundaries that you're gaining now with these multiple zone licenses, even with a regular license. So we wouldn't be losing that flexibility that exists now with those multiple zone or all season licenses.
Senator Ingebretson?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Can you just clarify to me why we have, I understand the 100, the 200, but why the 300? Why that wouldn't be 200?
Mr. Bogus?
Did I open up a can of worms? I'm sorry if I did.
Mr. Chair and Senator Ingebretson, that's an excellent question. And Lou's too young to answer it, I think, so at least he hasn't been in the state long enough. But it's a tradition that goes back to when these zones were established in the 1970s, where at one time in the agricultural part, well, even now in the agricultural parts of the state, we've had the split seasons that you're familiar with, where we have an early season and a late season. Originally, that was intended as a public safety and spreading the hunting pressure out kind of a thing, because in those agricultural areas, they tend to be pretty open, and there's a lot of hunters and not much cover and a lot of pressure on the deer. With the all-season and multi-zone licenses, we've seen kind of a merging in the southern and western part of the state of the early and the late seasons. There's many of the hunters are out both of the seasons, and we're actually proposing now to just have an extension of that as a single nine-day season rather than a split season. Zone 3 has never allowed that southeastern bluff country that's been the subject of a lot of discussion today, never allowed a person to use the all-season licenses in both seasons, so it's maintained the separation. There's a set of hunters that hunt early, and there's a set of hunters that hunt late, and never the twain shall meet. They don't have the option to hunt both like they do in Zone 4 to hunt in multiple zones. So it's being maintained because we're hearing not only the tradition, but the landowners that say it will reduce the number of hunters, because if they can hunt both, they'll hunt both. If we combine them all into 200, they're saying, well, we'll just hunt the whole thing. We won't let the second set of hunters come onto our property. We'll just continue to hunt the whole thing. So it's being maintained more because it kind of developed as a tradition and a history, and there's this sort of a platoon system of hunters there, but it's not intuitively obvious, so it's a good question. But as the group debated, Lou could comment on that, but I think they just felt like that's something that, at least for now, needs to be maintained as it has been more historically. There's no real management reason to do it other than to not lose hunting pressure. This has been an area of the state, that southeast has been an area of the state where we've had difficulty harvesting enough deer because land access is mostly private and it's very tightly held and you don't allow a lot of hunters to work. We do have some concern that this would reduce the amount of hunting that might take place in that part of the state. So I don't know if, Lou, you have anything to add on that?
Mr. Cornicelli, is part of the hunting licenses that are given out, or is that, I would assume that's part of your deer herd management?
Mr. Chairman, yes. It's.
I have a question from constituents who have wondered why we don't have deer hunting start days, and then as their deer are registered, you get a kind of a running total of the deer that are being taken, and that at some points in some areas, the hunt could just be extended. With modern technology, I mean, I have hunters who feel that would be a fairly easy number to track as the deer hunt was going on, and 2 or 3 days before the end day, on your website or through other means, you could announce that the hunt in a certain area has been extended in the attempt to take more deer.
Yep, Mr. Chairman. We could theoretically do something like that, extend deer seasons, but what we've learned is that once you get past the second weekend, and most of our seasons are 2 weekends, you really don't add much to the harvest. People just don't go back out. We do have some, we did with our bovine TB hunt, we had a late hunt and didn't take a lot of deer. We're learning that adding days to the, as we do a lot of research on harvest, we're learning that adding days to the season and deer to the bag, you get this point of diminishing returns. So we're really not changing behavior much. What we're doing is our early antlerless seasons are helping. The Ernebuck research we're doing on the state parks are working. So changing behavior influences deer harvest, but simply adding a couple days to the season likely wouldn't add much to the harvest. I think Mr. Bogus could comment. I think we tried that once in the 90s. It didn't go so well.
Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair, we have a couple of times in the southern part of the state extended seasons when there was severe weather, the first weekend or something like that, and they generally have not had the kind of participation. There is always some avid deer hunters that would like to keep going and help us manage the herd, but unfortunately they're the minority, and so it really hasn't added a lot of harvest.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Chaudhry.
I'll move the A08-1240 amendment to Senate File 3425.
Amendment is on the table. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Senator Chaudhry, to your bill.
Then we've got a couple of amendments that resulted from yesterday's discussion. The first is the A2.
The A2 amendment.
This addresses the turkey issue.
Senator Chaudhry, to the A2.
I defer to Mr. Knopf.
Mr. Knopf.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it was something that came up during yesterday's discussion. If you look on line 1.11 to 1.12, since you're getting rid of the turkey, you're getting rid of the turkey stamp requirement, people will be able to receive the turkey stamp now for basically for $2, and none of the money will be going into habitat or wild turkey management. It's basically to pay the cost of issuing the stamp.
The $2.
So what this would do is just remove some language that tells the duty of the commissioner to encourage the purchase. Right now it says by persons interested in wild turkey management. Since the money won't be going for that purpose, it seems like it doesn't make sense to be pushing it with those people. So that would just eliminate that. And then on lines 1.15 to 1.16, it would be another statement to have the commissioner encourage or basically ensure that the stamp design and characteristics are consistent with what the for all the stamps for what's sought by pictorial stamp collectors.
That was the what we mentioned yesterday, or what Mr. Bogus mentioned yesterday about the self-adhesive stamps are not really sought by stamp collectors. So if we're going to the turkey stamp just for kind of posterity, whoever would like to pay for one, then let's then let's make it one that's collectible so that those stamp collectors who buy those stamps can still collect them. And that will encourage production of the stamp and contests and such, at least for those purposes.
Questions to the A2? If not, Senator Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, just one point of information from yesterday when Senator Chaudhry asked how many of the pictorial turkey stamps are issued in 2007 out of 33,900 licenses that were available. We sold 5,372 pictorial stamps. So that was just a point of information from a question yesterday. The only other comment I would have is that the current stamp design was the result of having to create a self-mailer that we could run through a computer and address and send out. And we do this not only for turkey, but for trout and salmon and duck and pheasant. And so those self-mailers are designed, and that's the type of stamp that works with the self-mailer. So this new language on 1.15 and 1.16 could create some system or some fiscal issues that I'm not sure what they are today, but not sure we could use the self-mailer, and we might have to stuff envelopes or something like that, and that could be an issue for
Mr. Chair, why don't we figure that out, and then we'll change it if we need to or make adjustments.
Senator Chaudhry is willing to change that language if we need to, or are you still moving the A?
I'm still moving the A2, but let's just move on and we'll keep talking about it.
Other questions? To the A2 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Chair, the A3 deals with the discussion we had yesterday regarding the under 12 prairie chicken license. I'll have Mr. Knopf explain that one as well.
Mr. Knopf, some clarification.
And Mr. Chairman, the discussion yesterday was whether or not a person under the age of 12, because they don't have a firearm safety certificate, whether or not they could purchase a prairie chicken license. With the other changes that are in the bill now, it's going to allow people under the age of 12 to take prairie chicken. Of course, that would be they'd have to be with a parent or guardian in doing that, unless they're on their own property. But you can see that this is just modeled after the one right above it. Paragraph C, there's an existing provision for a turkey license comparable to allow that person to, as long as they're hunting with an adult parent or guardian, to allow them to purchase it. And so this is basically just a copy of that, only to allow it the same for prairie chicken as we do for turkey license in the state for those people under age 12.
Does this accomplish what you...
Senator Chaudhry? Was there?
Mr. Boggs indicates that this accomplishes the department's intent.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Knopf or Senator Chaudhry? To the A3 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a short amendment. Mr. Knopf has it. Could I have a copy of it?
Senator Chaudhry, we have another amendment being offered here.
Chairman, it's the A1 amendment. I move the A1 amendment.
Senator Fredrickson moves the A1 amendment. Senator Fredrickson, go ahead.
And after structure, I would say other than a self-propelled motor vehicle, that is, and that goes to a section later in the bill about what may be allowed on the ice. Make sure that a motor vehicle is not picked up by that.
This addresses your concern yesterday about whether or not a vehicle could be used as a fishing shelter.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, have you ever heard of the Willcraft?
No.
It's basically a TV/ice house. Seen this at sportsman shows, and it's kind of a flatter motor vehicle. And you sit in the back and use a stick to. It's got ATV tires. And it goes on, it travels like an ATV, except you're kind of sitting low. And then you get to your spot. It's got holes in it,
When you get to your spot, you flip over the top, and it becomes an ice house. So it's an ice house on wheels. You don't pull it. It is self-propelled. And so I don't know if this would apply or not.
Well, Mr. Chairman.
The rule remains that it cannot be left unattended. I mean, as long as it's attended, that's not a problem. I guess I don't know why you'd want to leave your such an expensive thing unattended, but it's not a big deal. I don't think there are a lot of them out there, but just a curiosity, and it might come up in the future.
Mr. Knopf?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to point out that if you look on page 13, starting in line 13.25, it says a person may not leave a dark house, fish house, or shelter. So this is an addition to the current law for a dark house or fish house and the shelter. So if it falls under a fish house or dark house, it would still, regardless of whether it was a motor vehicle or not, it would still fall under the current law. All this right. is because of the addition of shelter, it would mean that those motor vehicles that are not fish houses or dark houses.
All right. Got it.
Okay with that, Senator Chaudhry?
Thank you. To Senator Fredrickson's A1 amendment, any other questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Mr. Bogus has a couple issues.
Mr. Bogus.
Mr. Chair and members, I don't have anything drafted. I've had brief discussions with Mr. Knopf and Senator Fredrickson, and after the amendment yesterday on subdivision 7 on page 7, line 7.3, was amended to read on line 7.4 that a license to take antlerless deer to a resident or non-resident who is an owner or tenant of at least 80 acres of agricultural land. And after the hearing, we had some discussions internally, and the tenant, presumably someone who's leasing land, and some of our enforcement folks have pointed out that some of these leases are pretty informal, not even written necessarily, and so we're suggesting that if we would leave line 7.4 to read a license to take antlerless deer to a resident who is an owner or tenant, and then insert on line 7.5 or a non-resident who is an owner of at least 80 acres of agricultural land. I think that was what I heard Senator Fredrickson say yesterday, if they're paying taxes and so forth and are non-resident. I'm not sure if Senator Fredrickson would be okay with that because we didn't get a chance to talk in detail, but I think it would eliminate the issue of the non-resident tenant and what is required to be a tenant. What sort of a lease? Is it an agricultural lease? Is it a hunting lease? Is it written? So it's a suggestion for consideration. I don't know if we want to try to do it today or try to write it down and think about it some more, but it's an issue that came up since yesterday's hearing.
Senator Fredrickson?
Mr. Chairman, I think that would meet my my concern, yes.
Easy to do, as Mr. Knopf points out. Senator Fredrickson.
Reconsider?
Yep,
reconsider. Mr. Chairman, I would move to reconsider the amendment was it yesterday?
Yes.
I would move to reconsider the amendment whereby Section 11 was stricken from the bill.
We have a...
Actually, Mr. Chairman, it was not. It was the amendment was after the word "resident" on 7.4 to insert non-resident.
We need to get it before us first.
But Mr. Chairman, you did not move the amendment to strike Section 11. You did end up.
I thought we'd struck it. I think we were headed
in that direction and then changed our mind.
Okay, yeah. I'll take that, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Knopf, you have it written down. I could.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think Mr. Senator Fredrickson is reconsidering his amendment where he added the word "or non-resident" on line 7.4, and then I assume, Mr. Chairman, Senator Fredrickson, you might just withdraw that amendment, and offer the amendment on line 7.5 after tenant, insert "or a non-resident who is an owner." And I think there should be a comma before the "or," Mr. Chairman.
just to be clear.
We can do that all with one.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as long as Senator Fredrickson withdraws his previous, since you've called up, he probably needs to make a motion to, you should vote on the motion to reconsider his amendment.
And we have a motion in front of us to reconsider an amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? And then now, Senator Fredrickson, if you'd like to make an amendment.
First,
you should withdraw the previous amendment.
I'll withdraw the previous amendment and I'll offer the amendment that Mr. Knopf read.
Questions about the...
What section is that to, then?
Senator Parasol?
I wasn't here yesterday.
Right here.
7-5.
7-5.
Okay.
After the word tenant, we are adding... comma, or a non-resident who is an owner. To the amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Mr. Bogus, does that help?
Helps very much. I appreciate the committee's indulgence. Thank you.
Anything else, Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry is asking about the other issues. There was another issue on age 11, big game versus small game. We have looked at that a little bit, and I've talked to Mr. Knopf. It's on page 10, section 18. There's a lot of complexities with... ages at which you can get firearm safety, ages at which you have to be accompanied, ages born after. I think we agree with Senator Chaudhry's desire to look at this a little more comprehensively, but I don't think there's, talking with Mr. Knopf this morning, I don't think there's an easy, quick fix to this. Right now it's... the issue has been primarily the big game season where they have to have the license, and we don't have license requirements under age 16 for small game, so it hasn't been the issue there. But we do agree it's, and we've had this discussion with our commissioner, too, that this whole area is kind of confusing, and there's a section for possessing firearms, a section for taking small game, and a section for obtaining a license to take a protected wild animal that all relate to firearm safety certificates and accompaniment, and we have a whole page in our regulations book that lays out a chart for all these things, and it is something that that has caused some confusion. But we don't have a quick fix. But we would commit to look at either doing something more comprehensively to recodify some of that, maybe simplify it, or to come up with an easier to understand way of conveying those requirements. So,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Bogus, what would happen if after to take big game we added comma pheasants and comma and ducks? What would result from adding that?
Senator Chaudhry, could you give me a line there?
I'm sorry. Page 10, line 25.
Thank you. Mr. Bogus?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, right now, a person age 11 does not need a license to take pheasants or ducks.
And can't buy one.
And can't buy one, if I heard Mr. Knopf correctly. So
that's correct. Under existing law now, there is a move afoot to change existing law and create a free license for people in that age group, but that's not existing law. So so right now they don't need a license, so there wouldn't be a need for that. The question would be, when do they have to have a certificate? When is that certificate valid?
Senator Chaudhry, what would you like to do with this section for now?
We're just kind of thinking out loud, because we're saying that if you get your certificate by age when you're 11, but you're not going to turn 12 until December, let the kid deer hunt. Is that the basic gist? So what I'm asking is, same situation, let the kid hunt pheasants or ducks or both.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Senator Chaudhry, as I'm looking at this, I think actually we may already have addressed that up on line 10.23, where we say the certificate is not valid for hunting until the year the person reaches age 12. So we actually have
the year.
So we actually have allowed the 11-year-old certificate to become valid that year. I had missed that yesterday.
Okay.
So.
Okay. All right.
So that would be, we're covered under existing law. For the concern that was raised. Now, if that law changes and there's some free license for youth, we might have to revisit this.
So so the problem is the deer license. You need a license when you're that young to take deer, but for pheasant and ducks, you don't need a license when you're that young.
Mr. Boggs.
Senator Chaudhry, that's correct.
Got it. It's fine.
Senator Pearsall.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question about section subdivision 6 on page 12.
Page 12.
It's at the top of the page, and it's the resident, non-resident, deer of either sex allowance.
Right.
My question has to do with, they're on line 12, 6 and 7, where the commissioner may give preference to residents or non-residents under the age of 18.
Mr. Boggess?
I tend to quibble with the fact that non-residents could get preference even over residents who have not been selected, though they've applied in the past, in that category, age category.
Mr. Boggess.
So I'm wondering what the rationale for that, for the non-resident in that particular situation is, getting preference even over residents.
Mr. Chair and Senator Pearsall, the last year, you may recall, we allowed non-residents to get a deer license at a youth license at a resident fee. Non-residents under the age of 18. This section is dealing with youth under the age of 18 being able to take deer of either sex in lottery permit areas without having to get a permit. And the first sentence there just extends that. Right now, if you're in a lottery area, you have to have a permit to take an antlerless deer unless you're a resident under the age of 18. The first sentence would say, if you're in a lottery area, you have to have an antlerless permit to take an antlerless deer unless you're under 18, period, whether you're a resident or non-resident. The second sentence that you have the question about is referencing what we had a few years ago after those severe winters in 95, 96, and 96, 97 when we had bucks-only areas in the state. There were no antlerless permits. It wasn't even lottery. There were no antlerless permits. But as those areas began to recover, before we were able to open up the general lottery, we were able to offer some taking of antlerless deer by youth. And people with disabilities, and what the second sentence is doing is saying that in an antlerless permit area that's bucks only, we can provide a limited number of youth permits, and now we're broadening that out to either resident or non-resident youth under the age of 18. And the preference that's being referenced on line 12.7 is the preference that they get if they apply and don't get drawn for those. It's not preference over a resident. It's just preference for those that have not previously been selected. So if we offer, say, 50 youth permits and there's 100 youth that apply for them, it doesn't matter if they're a resident or a non-resident. If this passed, they would all those 50 that didn't get drawn would then get preference for the next year's drawing. They aren't getting any preference over a resident. It's just preference to those that have not previously been selected.
I get that because of the rest of the sentence, and I did understand that. But it seems to me that there's a possibility that non-residents who are over the age of 18 and are going to be in the same party with an under age 18 who has applied but never been selected would end up getting a preference over the people standing in line in the residence line who are under the same situation. So I think it's... it has a tendency to discriminate against our state's residents more than the non-residents. And I like to have non-residents come here to hunt, don't get me wrong, but.
Mr. Chair, Ms. Senator Paraso, this
sets up something that could be
this would strictly
unfair
give
to some of our people.
Yeah, this would strictly give preference based on if they've applied and not been drawn, and regardless of their residency. So, I'm not seeing how
it would, applied but not selected does not take into account whether you're resident or non.
It would not if this language right now only resident youth can apply for these youth permits. We're just saying any youth could, but their residency status would not affect whether they got preference. Only if they got drawn or not would affect if they got preference.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I haven't talked to them, the DNR, in private about this, which I've meant to, but as long as we're sitting at the table, I think the committee should hear my question at least as well, because we might need to act nimbly. The question I had was regarding the issue that's been brought up in some media about the timing of when we have to the timing of the validity of our fishing licenses. We changed that last year where it's valid up until which date now?
April 30th.
But some of the, like, for example, the trout stamp is not valid until April 30th. So then you have to buy a trout stamp, presumably, and hang on to that, and then buy additional license. There seemed to be a conflict there that was raised in the media, and I'm just interested in your response or whether we need to fix it. Or
Mr. Boggess. Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, there's actually an error in our fishing regulations booklet, because if you look in statutes, stamps are defined as licenses, and the change last year said licenses are valid, so a stamp is a license.
Okay.
And
right.
So actually those stamps do continue to be valid.
Right.
I would, since you give me the opportunity, though, I would mention that we're getting lots of confusion over that change as to what's valid when. And there's some issues with sturgeon seasons and trout seasons that still overlap license years. I think the intent was to not overlap license years or seasons, but now we're overlapping different seasons.
Mr. Boggess, is
it a confusing change?
Is it a re-education or is it a problem?
Part of the issue, Mr. Chair, was
Senator Chaudhry,
that when we passed the law, it was too late to include in the printing of the regulations, and that confused a lot. Then you have these other issues as well.
And Mr. Chair, we also print the on the licenses themselves the dates that those licenses are valid. So the law didn't take effect till last summer. Most of the fishing licenses had already been purchased. It said they were valid until the end of February. Now we're printing licenses that say they're valid until April 30th of 2009. So in regard to your question, whether it's a re-education or an actual problem, it may be more the former, that it's people will get used to the idea. We're also going to have to adjust our rules a little bit because we have a rule on sturgeon. We have a tag now, one tag per year for sturgeon, and our rules weren't real clear. We said one per license year, and now we've got kind of overlapping license year issue with a sturgeon season that overlaps April and May, and we should have been more clear in the rule if we would have anticipated that the license year was going to change. We could have said one per calendar year or something like that. So it has created some real issues, but they may not be insolvable. I'm just not sure if the, because this is now the only license that's valid beyond February, the fishing type license and shelter type licenses. I'm not sure that the fix reduced, complexity or increased.
Mr. Knopf points out that you could fix that by rule, though, right?
The sturgeon problem.
The sturgeon.
Yes, and that was, Mr. Chair, and that was my point. It created a problem, but not one that we couldn't fix by changing our rule. It's just that when we did the rule, it was an 18-month rule, and we hadn't anticipated this. So
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chaudhry, do we need to do anything to
correct any overlap or confusion in as a matter of this bill or in any other bill, or is the department going to take care of everything by rule?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, we don't have a proposal to fix anything this year. I think we'd still like to keep the question open, see how this kind of works out and what sorts of problems and confusion there is. But we can deal with any of the actual problems through rule this year. We don't have to fix anything in statute this year.
So will there be continued confusion for another year?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, the people may get used to it and figure it out. You know, a lot of times the confusion is just the change. You know, we don't have an official position on it, but we wouldn't have any problem if it just went back to the way it was.
Senator Chaudhry, did you have a fix in mind, or?
Well, I mean, if there's an overlap, then we need to fix the dates. And so that's what my question was: is what do we need to do to fix it? If we addressed one issue and created others, you know, I like the change that we made last year, but I don't want to create any other problems. If you can fix those problems in rule, but you're not going to, then I think we should do something in this bill.
Mr. Boggs. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, we can fix the problems in rule. I'm not sure we can get them done in time for this year's sturgeon season. So, but ultimately it will get fixed.
Senator Chaudhry?
Okay, we can keep talking about it.
If it doesn't get fixed, it won't go away, Senator, so.
Well, I think we need to do something this year. Either the department needs to do something or we need to do something this year. I don't understand why we would wait.
Senator, would you
if only just to add to the confusion that the politicians created and, you know, then end up going back to the old one. I mean, if there's a couple, three seasons or bags that we can change, and let's do it. So why don't we keep talking and
come to us with some recommendations?
Yep.
Thank you. Other questions for the witness or for Senator Chaudhry?
I don't know if this bill needs to go anywhere else.
Yes, it does.
It should go
state and local government.
State and local government, Senator.
We'll go to state and local government, and then I'll probably just re-refer it back here.
Mr.
Knopf.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, you may also need to go to the Finance Committee. There could be some financial implications. I think the important thing right now would be to send a state and local government, get a fiscal note for the bill of any changes.
Yeah.
And then, you know, the other option you have is you don't necessarily have to have it sent back to your committee. You could just have it passed out of state and local government to finance. You could still include the provisions in an omnibus bill that are here. I mean, we know what to include.
That's true, too.
Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair and committee, just for full disclosure, that just reminded me of a key point that I know this isn't the finance committee, but just so that the committee is aware, the deer simplification, elimination of an all-season deer license proposal that we're talking about does have a significant fiscal impact. A lot of the 77,000 all-season license buyers are not taking advantage of all three seasons, and if they can select only the ones that they want, it will have a significant fiscal impact. The increased revenue that's come in as a result of the license sales from that all-season license has been somewhat of a windfall, because that wasn't a license that the DNR necessarily sought, but it has injected an extra couple million dollars a year into the Game and Fish Fund that could go away if we do the simplification. We have another issue we're dealing with, which is the relative balance of hunting and fishing revenues and expenditures. But just so you don't feel blindsided, I felt obligated to mention there is a significant fiscal impact to the deer simplification.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Boggess, we won't be able to buy one license for everything?
Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, not under the the proposal that we've put forward, it would be you could buy three licenses that would accomplish everything, but there isn't one that does all three in our proposal.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Boggess, don't we want one like that?
Mr. Boggess.
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, I don't know that it would hurt anything to add a fourth license that's valid for all three seasons at triple the price like we have now. All I'm saying is that given the main reasons people seem to be buying the all-season license now are so they can cross zone boundaries and so that they can hunt the firearms in the muzzleloader season. Under our proposal, they would no longer need to buy an all-inclusive license to do those two things. So we're expecting the sales to go down.
Okay, so you buy a firearm license, and I can go into and I can cross zones?
Mr. Chair and Senator Chaudhry, yes, it would allow, because we're going to just create essentially one big zone except for the southeast part of the state for a late season, where the whole state's going to become one big zone but with different season lengths within that zone, so you could continue to cross.
I see. Maybe we need to think about that. Having one, and it doesn't have to be called all season so people think that it's what it was before. We can call it something else.
Other questions?
All right, let's think about that, too.
Senator Chaudhry has moved that Senate File 3425 as amended be recommended to pass and referred to state and local government. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Senator Chaudhry, do you have anything before we adjourn?
That's it.
Thanks for your patience and your time today, committee, and to the presenters. We're adjourned. Thank you.